Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
On this day in 1964, a young boxer stepped into the ring as a contender and stepped out of it a champion. Cassius Clay, who would later change his name to Muhammad Ali, defeated Sonny Liston for the heavyweight title. It also marked a turning point in Clay's relationship with another leading figure of that era, black nationalist Malcolm X. Their connection is explored in the new book, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Here's Karen Grigsby Bates from NPR's Code Switch team.
Malcolm and Ali are solo names globally recognized now, but in the early 60s, Malcolm X was the better known for his separatist views and his stinging criticism of American racism.
Black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years.
In Blood Brothers, historian Randy Roberts says for many Americans, Malcolm X was more notorious than famous.
You got to remember, at this time, the Nation of Islam is viewed by most Americans, particularly white Americans, as a hate organization.
While Ali, whose birth name was Cassius Clay, wasn't feared, he was dismissed as a cocky athlete.
I'm way ahead of schedule. My time and my accuracy. The man is sore. The man is flat-footed. The man don't stand a chance. The stage has been set.
Malcolm and Clay first met in May 1962 at a Nation of Islam rally in Detroit, where Malcolm was the opening speaker. They each came away impressed. Historian and co-author Johnny Smith says young Cassius had never heard a black man speak like Malcolm.
There was this confidence, this authority that Malcolm offered, you know, when he spoke at the podium that day, and it made a profound impression on young Cassius Clay.
Malcolm was struck by the young boxer's magnetism. He believed people could be drawn to the Nation by Clay's swagger.
I'm a poet, I'm a prophet. I'm the resurrector. I'm the savior of the boxing world. If it wasn't for me, the game would be dead.
They developed a warm friendship. Malcolm was part big brother, part father figure to young Cassius, and Cassius, searching for a spiritual home, found it in Malcolm and the Nation of Islam. Randy Roberts says initially, the boxer didn't advertise his relationship with Malcolm because the Nation of Islam terrified much of America, including the civil rights establishment and the boxing industry.
If he's a member of this organization, his career is over. You can write him off. He will never get a shot at the championship.
So Clay continued to learn about the Nation and adopted some of its practices, like giving up pork, quietly. At the weigh-in before his match with world heavyweight champ Sonny Liston, Clay only talked about the fight, not his faith.
I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat. If you like to lose your money, be a fool and bet on Sonny.
Clay predicted he'd beat Liston in 8 rounds. Wrong. He beat him in 7.
And what's happened? Clay has won! Clay has won!
The day after his victory over Liston, Clay announced he was indeed a member of the Nation of Islam. A month later, he would become Muhammad Ali and remain an activist athlete. He and Malcolm openly continued their friendship, but Malcolm's stock in the Nation and with its founder, Elijah Muhammad, was slipping just as Ali's fame was beginning to soar. Johnny Smith.
There are people that are close to Elijah Muhammad who feel like, you know, we don't really need Malcolm X, especially now that we have the heavyweight champion who can be a better spokesman for us.
Malcolm left the Nation of Islam after he discovered Elijah Muhammad had several children by his young secretaries, and he went public with the discovery. That shattered his friendship with Ali. The two never repaired the rift. They met physically only once more when they ended up on the same plaza in Accra, Ghana. Johnny Smith.
Their eyes meet. And at that moment, Malcolm says, "Brother Muhammad," he's got this half smile on his face. And Muhammad Ali, just stone-faced, says, "Brother Malcolm, you shouldn't have crossed the Honorable Elijah Muhammad." And he essentially walks away from him.
Malcolm, by then a marked man, was assassinated early the next year. Randy Roberts says that moment in Accra haunted Ali.
One of his greatest regrets is that he never patched it up with Malcolm, that he didn't tell Malcolm how important Malcolm was to him, that he wasn't able to explain that really, without Malcolm, he would never have become Muhammad Ali.
The friendship between the two was ended, but the fusion of politics and sports that Ali and Malcolm began continues to this day.
Well, what's the one thing?
Karen
Grigsby-Bates,
NPR News.
Charles Barkley, what would it be?
I would like for kids to stay in the college longer because I think we bring a lot of guys into the NBA who are not mentally or physically ready. You know, college is a really good time.
It's estimated that college sports in America generate $13 billion annually. The money enriches schools, coaches, conferences, TV networks, and apparel companies, everyone except those who actually play the sports. Recently, fans have begun to note that athletes accept scholarships at the price of absolute submission to the whims of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, an organization that seems to put their interests dead last. In a new book called Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA, New York Times columnist Joe Nocera and Times contributing writer Ben Strauss tell the story of the players, lawyers, and others who are taking on an organization that was created to protect the so-called student athletes. I'm pleased to welcome Joe Nocera back to our show. Hello.
Hello, how are you? And so-called student athletes is about as apt as you can put it.
And we'll get to how they came up with that name. 4 years ago, you published a controversial article in the Times in which you wrote, "How can the NCAA blithely wreck careers without regard to due process or common fairness? How can it act so ruthlessly to enforce rules that are so petty? Why won't anybody stand up to these outrageous violations of American values and American justice?" Is the NCAA really that bad?
Yes, actually they are. their rule book is about 400 and some odd pages long and covers everything from how often an athlete can eat in someone's home during a semester to what high school courses are allowable to get into college. The bureaucrats in Indianapolis are making that decision, whether a course is allowed or not. It's absurd. There are no due process rights for any athlete who gets in trouble with the NCAA. They can do whatever they want. They can base it on hearsay. They can base it on accusations made by an angry ex-boyfriend. Their punishments have no particular rhyme or reason. And then the third set of issues, there's the issue of money. Is it really appropriate that Mike Krzyzewski, the coach of Duke basketball, makes literally $10 million a year and his players make nothing?
The NCAA was formed out of White House conferences that were convened by President Theodore Roosevelt to encourage reforms to college football practices, which had resulted in repeated injuries and deaths and, quote, prompted many colleges and universities to discontinue the sport. So its original mission was a positive one.
Oh, sure it was. And those reforms did happen very quickly. They were mostly led by the presidents of Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, which were big football powers at the turn of the last century.
So when did that change?
It changed in the 1950s. It was a toothless organization until 1951, when it got a 29-year-old executive director who understood power, how to grab it, how to use it, how to instill fear, and he molded the NCAA into the what I would say the ruthless, heartless, bureaucratic organization it is today.
That's Walter Byers?
His name is Walter Byers, I'm sorry.
Now, it's interesting that T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, tried to bust cartels. The NCAA has been called a classic cartel. Would you agree with the notion that, in theory, the NCAA and its original mission were, in fact, noble?
I think noble is a slight overstatement. It gets to the issue of whether you believe in this thing called amateurism or not. Amateurism, even in its old days, was a way of keeping the working class out in Britain when it first evolved. In the United States, you know, the idea of protecting athletes from commercialism maybe made some sense in the 1950s or 1960s, but by the 1970s, as television really started to move in and as sports, college sports became a bigger and bigger business, amateurism rules became an excuse to not pay the labor force.
But other athletic officials like Avery Brundage argued about keeping amateurs, the sports purely amateur. He said that athletes should compete for the love of the game itself without thought of reward or payment of any kind. He said professionals are part of the entertainment business and amateurism expressed the concept of the Renaissance man with abilities in many fields and a specialist in none. Now, well, of course, Avery Brundage came from a very wealthy family.
That's a great piece of propaganda. And the Olympics today, of course, are not played by amateurs. Avery Brundage was the head of the Olympics for many years, and that's what he believed.
And his pure ideas actually ruined the lives of Jim Thorpe and Jesse Owens.
Sure, just as college sports ruins the lives of many poor black disadvantaged kids who think they're going to be pros and don't become a pro and don't get a decent education.
Do the colleges function as the minor leagues for professional sports?
Absolutely, 100%. The difference between hockey and baseball and football and basketball is that hockey and baseball began as professional sports. So they had a minor league system. They needed to develop a minor league system that exists to this day. Basketball and football began as college sports. And the pro leagues grew out of college, and it was the college players, the fame of the college players, that made the pro league viable. So there's never been any incentive for basketball or football to have a minor league. Why would they? They have a free minor league in college.
Now, you mentioned that Byers is the one who coined the term student-athlete.
Right.
Can you talk about the evolution of that phrase?
There's not really an evolution. It just happened one day. Byers was worried that several states were thinking about classifying college football players as employees for the purposes of giving them workman's compensation. Byers' solution to this was to coin the phrase student-athlete, student first, athlete second, and then to impose it on everybody in college athletics. In other words, a mandate went out. You don't call them athletes anymore. You don't call them players anymore. You call them student-athletes. You ingrain in the country that that's what they are. And it worked. The whole idea of them being employees and deserving workman's compensation if they're injured went away.
Has the NCAA encouraged the commercialization of college athletics in ways not related to the athletes themselves?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. The March Madness tournament that's going to happen next year, they're going to have Coca-Cola is going to be the official soft drink. Somebody's going to be the official rental car. Somebody's going to be the official airline. The NCAA actually has a model. They call it the collegiate model. And at its root is the idea that everything in college sports should be about maximizing revenues and professionalizing it, except the athletes who have to remain amateurs.
Hasn't ESPN agreed to pay the NCAA $7.3 billion for a 12-year contract to televise the college football playoffs? Who gets all of that money?
Well, the main people who get the money are the five major conferences that cooked up the college playoff system in the first place. The NCAA itself really doesn't get any of that money because the NCAA really has very little to do with football. They have a lot to do with basketball, but very little to do with football. So it goes to the conferences, and then the conferences divvy it up as they see fit among their members.
Any of it go to academic support?
Absolutely not.
So the scholarships are not paid for at all by all of this money that's being generated?
Well, it depends on what you mean by pay for a scholarship. They would argue that they are, but it's if you give somebody a free scholarship, is anybody actually paying for that? I think there's something mythical about the idea that college sports is spending billions of dollars on scholarships.
What happens to an athlete's scholarship when he or she suffers a season or a career-ending injury?
Okay, well, that is changing, thankfully. It used to be mandated that athletes could only get one-year scholarships, and it had to be renewed by the coaches. Needless to say, the coaches loved this system because they could cut athletes who weren't cutting it. They'd lose their scholarship. But there's been so much pushback in the last few years and so much bad publicity that there are some schools that are giving four-year scholarships now. And the NCAA now allows a player who's permanently injured to keep his scholarship and even allow the team to add a scholarship. So that's one area that used to be terrible, and it's not as terrible as it used to be.
I'm talking with Joe Nocera, who with Ben Strauss has written Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA. What do you say to those who argue that most college basketball and football players receive a free four-year college education, not held to the same qualifications for entrance as regular applicants, and often have an easier academic schedule?
Here's what I say. There's a history professor at the University of North Carolina that I quoted several weeks ago when I went down to North Carolina to write about the ongoing, terrible fake class scandal that emanated from the African American Studies Department. And he wrote a letter to somebody who was complaining that the athletes had got a free ride and everything. And he said, the bargain universities make is that they will give these, in return for their arduous, dangerous labor, they will get an education. And then they erect barriers to make it almost impossible to get that education or for it to be meaningful. And he said, I view this bargain as fundamentally immoral. I agree with that. I think that's right. I think if athletes really got an education and really came out of there prepared for a better life, then, yeah, you could make an argument that Mike Krzyzewski can make his $10 million and it's okay because the athletes are getting a lifetime of benefit. But that's not what happens.
And you mentioned that the majority of athletes who play college football and men's basketball are African American. Can you discuss the ways in which race and class enter into your argument against the NCAA?
I think race has a heck of a lot to do with it. I think race is an important factor. In the first place, there's the issue of money. A lot of poor black players get in trouble because their mothers don't have the money to fly to the recruiting visit. They get the money from a friend or a coach, and that's viewed as an impermissible benefit. So the issue of money, you know, the middle-class white kid, his parents can just buy a ticket. There's no issue. The second issue is that the NCAA is deeply suspicious of any help that a black athlete gets from a mentor or a benefactor, especially if that person's white. And you'll often see investigations around that. And
I mean, if some white mentor pays for the kid to go to the school, it pays for his or her parents to go to the school?
Yeah, yeah. So that becomes...
People are penalized for that?
Without question. I mean...
Well, how are they supposed to get to the school?
Exactly. They're not. That's right. Because they're poor. And the prologue of my book is about a particular case revolving around that, having to do with a player named Ryan Boatwright from UConn, who was whose mother was basically tortured by the NCAA because they were suspicious of his AAU coach, who was her friend. And what they put her through, including a five-hour interrogation in a hotel room with four white guys and not even letting her making a phone call out to her parents who were taking care of her other three kids, it's beyond horrendous. It's just plain wrong.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
This was a high-profile case that caused outrage on this campus 3 years ago. Three of those students were charged with misdemeanor battery and not a hate crime, which is a felony.
You can't just get away with just doing like a little slap on the wrist like...
The victim claims that his former roommates bullied him, put a U-shaped bicycle lock around his neck and refused to give him the keys to open it, locked him in a closet and hung a Confederate flag in their room. At the time, DJ Williams, who happens to be black, was a freshman, and the guys that bullied him were white. The defendants claim they were all pranks.
So when I heard about that, I was like in shock, because coming here, like, everyone is super friendly. Nobody really does anything that just makes you question, like, that was a little bit racist. Like, I wonder what his background is like, so.
There was a fourth student that was also involved and charged. The details of his case aren't being released because at the time of the assault, he was a juvenile. None of those four students are currently enrolled at San Jose State.
They should face a far more severe punishment than just what they got.
The school has taken measures to address racial concerns on campus. After Monday's ruling, letters were sent to students letting them know that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in order to create a more inclusive environment on campus, including a search for a chief diversity officer, in which they plan on making a decision soon. DJ Williams and his family did not get the ruling they were hoping for. They do plan to pursue civil claims against those four former students. Reporting in San Jose, Alicia Reed, Cron 4 News.
Come on, guys, what is this?
Oh, looks like someone needs a chill pill.
I thought I asked for an African-American to replace Terry.
You requested an Afro-American?
African-American. Jerry, you know I did. I put it in writing.
I didn't see it. You see it?
If you don't like her, you send her back.
Yeah, you tell her you didn't like her performance because she was white.
What? That's not the point.
Flipper, she's been here for 5 minutes. Give her a chance. This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
Students feel about this. One says he wants an apology from the college president.
News 10 ABC's Rachel Yankunis continues our team coverage live at UAlbany tonight. Rachel?
That's right. He's calling out to the president this evening, writing him a big letter. And after many students saw this video, they say that they're disappointed. It does not match the story of those three women. They're afraid this will desensitize others to the bigger issues of racism. And we're also hearing from one of these defendants' lawyers. It's the video everyone has been waiting to see. CDTA bus video that police say shows the three self-proclaimed victims as the aggressors in this January 30th incident.
Not a good look for if someone else were to make some similar allegation like that.
Students realizing the women may have twisted the story.
It definitely looks like it wasn't what the girl said it was that happened. And actually it looks like the opposite.
Now they are the ones facing assault charges. Community activist Alice Green tells me instead of choosing sides, people should choose a dialogue, one to understand the different perceptions about race.
Racism is a very complex, difficult issue. And if we can have the kinds of give and take and discussions, those issues are much bigger than this.
The students have kept quiet since this rally, but tonight, Ariel Agudio's attorney says this video doesn't show the whole story.
We believe these charges are unwarranted. The other information that the university police say that they have, much of it has not been released publicly.
But for many of the students, UAlbany President Robert Jones owes them an apology. They feel he acted unfairly with his initial response and hasn't addressed other possible victims since.
He took these girls' word for it that it actually happened. It's just not fair because one student actually left campus because he thought his life was threatened.
Yeah, he left because he had he just didn't feel safe here, and that's not something fair for this university. We should be all feel safe.
Now, university police chief wanted to point out that this incident was not a hate crime, and in fact, the only person investigators say they heard any racial slurs from came from one of the defendants. Live in UAlbany, I'm Rachel Yankunis for News 10 ABC.
Very derogatory, and she can't say that.
Offensive. That's how parents describe this text from a school principal. The message sent to address how male students at Redemptorist Elementary were presenting themselves.
New tonight, parents are taking issue with the content of that message. And News 2's Brittany Wise joins us now with more on the situation. Brittany, so why are parents so upset?
Parents we spoke with say the wording in the text was inappropriate and think the principal should stick to the handbook.
Six-year-old Carter, a student at Redemptorist, likes his hair just how it is.
And that's the hair that he's comfortable with.
He wears it natural, curly. But after his mom got a text from the school principal saying hair like this might not be allowed, she's offended.
You're telling me I have to cut my son's hair because of whatever look that you're sick of seeing that's getting out of hand.
The text went to all parents. It reads, quote, the nappy, uncombed, unmaintained, picked sponge look must go. And if their haircut is higher than 1 inch, it must be cut.
Initially, I thought it was some type of joke.
Carter's grandmother, Mary Brooks, says that type of language shouldn't have been used.
To say that word, nappy, in a text, let me know that she was the person that just didn't care as far as what she said. And I figure if you put it in writing, then you'll say it just as well to the children, and that's not right.
The Catholic Diocese says Redemptorist Principal Erica Walker recently reminded students and their parents of its policy. But the Brookses say the text message doesn't match up with the hair lengths and styles the handbook says aren't allowed.
If she had referred back to the handbook, as opposed to making this a personal issue, I would have felt better about it.
She should have known better than to use those terms, right. Nappy.
This six-year-old says his hair is a form of expression, and he's not planning to get a trim anytime soon.
My son is an honor roll student. Why does his hair matter, you know?
We spoke to the diocese tonight. They assured us the text message was not intended to be offensive to anyone, and the matter will be handled.
All around the world.
World nigga law.
We start with last night's conflict. On the rugby pitch of the University of the Free State, video shot and cell phones appears to show protesters moving onto the field during last night's rugby match. Then, as the players leave the field, spectators run onto the field and start to hit and kick the protesters. The demonstrators were black. The spectators who attacked them, it seems, were all white. EWN's Mia Lindeke is on the campus now of the University of the Free State for us in Bloemfontein. Mia, good afternoon to you. It now appears there's some other acts of violence this lunchtime. What's happening there now?
Yes, Stephen. Earlier, students marched from the main campus entrance to the law faculty here where I am, where they burned the statue of apartheid leader Charles Roberts Swart, who was the first state president in the 1960s. Now, the statue's hands are tied together with a chain, while the rest of his body is covered with something, it looks like melted plastic, greenish. The building is currently known as the CR Swart Law Building, and students want it to be changed. So they spray-painted the words Robert Sobukwe on two walls. But just a short while ago, two men with a can of paint came to the building, and I assume on instruction of management, and they painted over the graffiti. But still, there are obvious tensions, but the situation is calm for now, Stephen. Protesters have now dispersed, and they've gone back to the main entrance of the campus. But police are here at the statue, just monitoring everything.
Mir, at this stage last night, we've seen various videos on Twitter about what happened. What do we know about what actually started what happened on the rugby field last night? What actually happened?
I've spoken to a number of students here, Stephen, and they claim basically that it was a peaceful march. Yesterday morning, they joined workers who were against outsourcing. And when it was about after 6 o'clock, they went to the rugby stadium where the Varsity Cup was underway. And they claim that they were peacefully marching, holding hands, singing. And during halftime, they went onto the field. They claim that then out of the blue, white students with their parents came, were watching, and they were sitting on the pavilion and they were watching the game. They stormed onto the field and they started beating them. I spoke to one female student who says that she was beaten by a white parent and she felt hopeless. There were also older people among the protesters. And they claim that after the match, even students and their parents went to residence and were looking for the SRC president. They wanted to continue with the violence.
At this stage, then, police on the campus at the University of the Free State, you talk about tensions there. Are most of the students actually on campus, or is the campus nearly empty?
Protesting students are here. I've just seen three students who came to see what happened here at the law building. They're seeing on social media what is happening. They're here of more graffiti near a building at the other side of the campus. So students are curious. Students are hanging out here. They basically just want to see what's happening. But classes have been, there are no classes at this stage. So the management said that for security reasons, they have closed the campus for today and tomorrow as well. But management, they are concerned about what's happening, but obviously they have placed the police on campus to make sure that every student is safe.
That's EWN's Mia Lindeke from the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein. Mia, thank you. We were due to speak to the University of the Free State themselves. We were unable to get through to them. We were also due to speak to the SSE president, Linda Kushle and Thule at that university. Also, I think events moving very quickly there. They're battling to keep up with demands from people like ourselves. But there is a statement from the University of the Free State. This is their official statement. This is how they see what happened last night. The rugby players of both teams, as well as the match officials, immediately cleared the field as protesters moved across the field towards the halfway line. Members of the UFS Protection Services gathered around the protesters but were outnumbered. After a few minutes, spectators ran onto the field. The protesters were chased off the field and beaten by the spectators. That's from the official statement from the University of the Free State. They say they condemn in the strongest terms possible the violence against the protesters and that no one has the right to take the law into their own hands. That's the official statement from the University of the Free State. If we're able to get through to them, we'll try and get more from them during the midday report.
Rachel Zellers, thank you for joining me.
Oh, I'm happy to join you again.
So have the offensive names been changed?
Well, the names themselves haven't been changed. They're still in the deofficialized, holding pool, if you will. And the process to change the names is a pretty long and protracted one, and it means organizing a number of Black scholars here in the city to work together to create a proposed list of changes that honor some of the folks that lived and died around those sites, and it's a work in process.
So the Toponymy Commission has accepted the contribution of Black scholars here in Quebec?
that's generous. Not outright. There's still quite some contention that I foresee in the long haul for these name changes. The first is that one of the first efforts that I led after the deofficialized announcement was made by the Toponymy Commission was to organize over a dozen local geographers from both the English and French universities and insist in a letter, an open letter to the Toponymy Commission, that as geographers, not only do they support the proper name changes, but they also demand that the name changes be made by scholars who have a background in the history of Black life in Quebec. And the Toponymy Commission has remained consistently silent, both in response to my letters and has not responded to the letter that this group of geographers collectively sent. So my work on the outside has been to really speak to folks in the community who are more knowledgeable about the history of this place than I am and begin one by one approaching them to see if they would be willing to come to the center of a renaming process, a renaming committee, if you will, to propose a list of names to the Toponymy Commission. The protracted process exists in the fact that, you know, even after we get together and work together to create these names, I foresee that we still will have to create other areas of solidarity in the city to insist that the Toponymy Commission actually uses the names that we recommend. It doesn't have to. But that will take some work and greater solidarity when the moment comes, certainly.
Now, last summer, Don Phillip, director of the Black Coalition of Quebec, said he was not in favor of dropping the names. He said that it wouldn't really advance the interests of Black people in Quebec. What do you say to this view?
I disagree, and I've had a number of conversations with Black elders in Montreal about this very point. The issues of disagreement tend to sit on two very different prongs of opposition, if you will. The first is that there's a fear that in changing the name, somehow history will be lost. And then the second argument that I've had a lot of time to talk about with folks is the issue of violence. And it's the argument that there's actually more need, or it's better to leave the symbolic violence that's attached to some of these sites than to have it erased completely. And I've disagreed on both grounds. I disagree on the point of history, because there's nothing about leaving these places named as they are that tells us anything about the history of those places. That's the point about the naming. In addition to the violence of the name, we don't know the history of those locations. And leaving an offensive and harmful name in those places doesn't further tell us anything about history. It simply preserves that icon, that image, that representation of Black life, which is a form of violence in itself. And the point about violence is probably most close to my heart, because I believe that anti-Blackness and racism in the context of anti-Blackness is a pervasive, permanent structure. It doesn't shift and change readily, and I see it as not, you know, disappearing anytime soon. However, and I thought about this a lot when the United States was engaging in its own debates around the Confederate flag, when particular places have traditions of violence attached to that city, that community, and particular histories of erasure of Black life, of Black history, of the existence of Black peoples in a particular place, there's something even more violent about leaving a name like nigger or neg attached to place names as a representation of Black or African or Afro-Canadian or African Quebec or whatever the term that is less offensive actually is. And I thought about this young woman in South Carolina, Bree Newsom, who climbed the flagpole to remove the Confederate flag from flying over the state capitol. And I thought, similar to the issue that we have here, Bree Newsom was not pulling down this offensive symbol for the point of eradicating white supremacy in South Carolina, nor was she pulling the flag down to somehow conceal the history of slavery or the Civil War in that place. She was simply pulling down the flag because for her grandmother and great-grandmother, for whom the Confederate flag serves as an enduring symbol of violence, it makes sense to do that, to create less harm in the lives of people before her who have lived through traumas that she does not currently carry in her body. And I think of, you know, these place names similarly here. There's something greater in the freedom that we imagine as Black peoples who are so varied in this place. There's something greater in the freedom that we can imagine beyond keeping these names attached to the place and struggling in a very different capacity to create names that really honor our dead and our histories than leaving these names. There's a greater freedom that we have yet to imagine. And for me, that's the point and lesson in Bree Newsom's efforts of bringing down the Confederate flag in South Carolina.
Do you have any ideas yourself? Do you have any suggestions? Can you give me an idea of what would be how you would capture all of this in a name? Mm. Let's say what is known as Nigger Rock, which is a place where many Black people are buried.
So for me, the freedom is in the process, not simply in the naming of the thing itself. The freedom is in the way that we first imagine what our lives look like here and in being willing to hold on for the long haul, right? This ties back to the point for me, importantly, of how Black struggle works. Most of the people that I hold up in my life as personal heroes, Ida B. Wells and Martin Luther King and all of these other names that we know, are folks who died before they ever saw their life's work, their entire commitment and body of life's work, have an end goal or have something formative and pragmatic at the end of it. They died. And so I think about, you know, one of the things that we have to be willing to do in this place in particular is imagine what it means to struggle as a part of a different kind of freedom in which the end goal is not the sole thing that matters. Now, pertaining to those names themselves, I certainly do have some ideas about what they should be or could be. And what I'll say to you now, because we haven't selected a list of names to submit to the Toponymy Commission, is that those names must reflect parts of history that we are not commonly talked about and discussed in this place. They must honor the dead, the black folks that perished and around or next to some of these sites, by simply naming them or choosing names that, you know, symbolize those bodies, those peoples that worked and lived on those lands. Nigger Rock could be, as other people before me have suggested, it could be Slave Rock, and it could signify, in my mind, even better, a history that's connected to that location. Currently in a way that we don't know. Many, I would argue most Quebecers don't know about that history and certainly will not know it through the term Nigger Rock.
And, of course, many Canadians labor under the illusion that there were no slaves in Canada.
Indeed, still, right? So I think, I think that the first point, the starting point, is to imagine in this process for me, and hopefully for others, to imagine what freedom looks like when it's part of a protracted, a long struggle. The end goal for me has never been simply naming these things and erasing such offensive terms. That's only part of the struggle. The long-term goals for me have been about what it means to use this as an example to call for institutional investments in the study of Black Quebecer life and Black Canadian life broadly at our institutions, our universities, our colleges, in the form of master's and PhDs. Currently, there are none. And what we know, as I think you and I have talked before about, is that Black studies programs, cultural-focused studies, have been around in the United States since the 1960s. We are simply well behind the time in terms of investing in the study of certain kinds of lives in Canada.
Rachel Zellers, thank you for telling me about it.
Thank you so much again. I'll speak with you soon, hopefully.
Mama says policemen shoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
It's unacceptable, and we want to make our voices heard.
Stephen Corson.
She is a person just like me, who probably had goals and aspirations.
And Kari Lucas. The pair didn't know Joyce Cornell, but when they recently heard what happened to the 50-year-old...
There's a time where you have to finally say, I'm drawing the line here, and I won't stand for this anymore.
They wanted to do something. This story starts here, last July, at Roper St. Francis. Cornell was being treated for a stomach illness. The next day at the hospital, she was arrested on a warrant for shoplifting after being medically discharged and taken to the Charleston County Jail. 27 hours later, though, she was dead. Court documents filed this week allege Cornell vomited through the night. The autopsy report shows she died from gastroenteritis, but the lawyer's expert says, quote, Miss Cornell died because she was deprived of water. She was too sick to tolerate the dehydration. According to the sheriff's department, staff saw her at 2:12 p.m. for a medical check. She was found unresponsive 3 hours later.
It's bigger than just this incident.
Back with Corson and Lucas, they're planning a peaceful march for Friday here at Marion Square. They hope to educate people on Cornell's story and in turn create change.
They need to have a better vetting of the medical staff there, a better vetting of the officers who are supposed to be taking care of citizens. Police are meant to protect, and what have they done for Joyce? What have they done for Joyce?
They have laws for pedestrians, you know, like you cross the street, they have laws for pedestrians, but they don't have laws for people at night when cops accidentally shoot people. I mean, they accidentally shoot more niggas out here than any place in the world. Every time you pick up a paper, nigga accidentally shot in the ass. How do you accidentally shoot a nigga 6 times in the chest? Well, my gun fell and just went crazy.
For something you don't see in the streets every day, hundreds or thousands of Chinese Americans in cities around the country protesting a jury verdict. But that's what happened over the weekend in New York, Philadelphia, L.A., Las Vegas, and elsewhere over the manslaughter conviction in Brooklyn of New York City police officer Peter Liang for shooting Akai Gurley, a totally innocent and unarmed 28-year-old man, in a stairwell in the Pink Houses in East New York. The protesters accept Liang's defense that the jury rejected, that the shooting was merely an accident, not a crime, and they say Liang is being made a scapegoat for other police killings around the country, and because he's Chinese-American. One spokesman for this point of view is the former New York City comptroller and 2013 mayoral hopeful John Liu, currently a professor of public finance at Columbia and CUNY. Hi, John. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for doing this because there are a lot of issues here that can't be captured in sound bites.
You were pretty tough on police excess and police brutality when you were running for mayor. Why are you joining this protest movement?
I have been very much in favor of criminal justice reform, and really being one of the very first people adamantly against stop and frisk. This is an issue that's very important on a number of different levels. And, you know, pardon the pun or cliche here, but it's not a black and white issue.
Go ahead.
Well, we have had, as you explained, thousands of people out there on Saturday morning here in New York City and also in 30-some-odd cities across the country, hundreds and in many cases thousands of people in those places coming out to really call for equal justice. And I think it's important for people to understand that Asian Americans don't think that Peter Liang is innocent. He was found guilty of official misconduct. He lost his job. He's going to pay a price for that crime. But people really feel that to say it was manslaughter is just way too much. And for the prosecutor to have changed his tune towards the end of the trial to say that Officer Liang actually deliberately and recklessly aimed the gun at Akai Gurley, when, in fact, this was an accident where a rookie officer was put in a dark stairwell and he was startled, he was afraid for his life, and the gun accidentally went off. And, you know, one in a million chance that the bullet would ricochet off the wall and go right into Akai Gurley's heart. A tragic, horrific accident, one that Peter Liang will pay a price for. But to say manslaughter and possibly send him to jail for 15 years, Asian Americans feel that this is also unjust because it's a case where the punishment doesn't fit the crime.
The jury in the case heard all the evidence and drew its conclusions. I think the judge who could have thrown out the verdict was Chinese-American. Am I mistaken about that?
And Judge Chun is Korean-American.
Korean-American.
He's fellow Asian-American.
Korean-American. This isn't even second-guessing a DA or a grand jury steered by a DA before trial. You're second-guessing a jury that heard the vigorous defense put on by the police officer's lawyers and had to vote unanimously to get a conviction, as all juries do. Why should we think you know better than the jury?
I don't think that anybody's second-guessing anything here. There is an appeals process. And there is a sentencing that is going to take place a little less than 2 months from now. And what the people are out there in thousands calling for is equal justice. And now, I think it's also important to see that this is a lot more than just Peter Liang. Asian Americans know how much pain and injustice the African American community has faced. And with all of the killings of innocent people, it's always an unarmed black man who gets killed. And that is not lost upon Asian Americans. But at the same time, it's right for Asian Americans to stand up whenever they see that there is an unequal level of justice. And the inequality here is that, you know, let's remember the backdrop of what happened here. You have a young African American being shot, I think it was point blank, in a patrol car. This is in Ferguson. No charges, no nothing.
That was in, the Ferguson, he was running toward the officers, so that was a different situation.
I'm sorry, yes. Unfortunately, there have been so many cases where unarmed young black men have been killed by the police, even just within the last 2 or 3 years. But the situation is the same, that the officers don't get charged with anything. They keep their jobs. And, in fact, we have seen some cases where police officers were involved in killings, and they got promotions not too long thereafter. We also remember, at the same time, have the case of Eric Garner, who was put in an illegal chokehold, killed all of this being captured on video.
Do you think the...
And also, no charges, nothing.
Do you think there should have been charges in the Garner case?
I think there should have been indictments in all of these cases because, look, indictments are not convictions. Indictments are a way to start the process to really open up exactly what happened, look at the evidence, air out the facts, and see what punishment, event, if necessary, should be had.
But then
but
instead
in none of those cases, in none of those cases was there any kind of action. And then now you have Liang put on trial. Now, look. I didn't have any issue with having the indictment, but the ultimate verdict of manslaughter is also felt as unjust. It's not. It's just not equal justice.
Well, let me follow up. Instead of seeing Officer Liang's conviction as singling him out, when other officers who killed unarmed people unjustifiably go free, why not see this conviction as part of a new era of holding guilty police officers accountable for their actions? Because before the backlash to Ferguson and Eric Garner, these indictments and convictions were happening more rarely, as you point out. Now in...
They never happened.
They never happened. Well, we're on the
they never happened.
We're on the same page.
The last time was, but the last time was 10 years ago in New York City when an officer chased the victim down,
right,
cornered him in the hallway, and shot him.
So what standard do you want to set? Because now in Baltimore, maybe that's the case in the patrol car or police van you were thinking of, and here in Brooklyn,
the standard,
and in North Charleston, hang on, and elsewhere, they're beginning to happen. So why not see the Liang conviction as part of a new era of the justice system getting it right rather than compare it to the past of the justice system getting it wrong?
Well, that's a very good point, and one that I actually agree with, that perhaps Liang's conviction is a change in the tone and the tide, and finally people are getting justice when unarmed, innocent people, mostly black men, are being killed by the police. And you would see that in his indictment, in Liang's indictment. You would see that in Liang's being convicted of official misconduct, because he did nothing to help this person after he realized that somebody had been shot, accidentally as it may be. And you would see that change, or the change in the tide, in his losing job, in his losing his job. But Asian Americans just feel that to say it was manslaughter, that he recklessly and deliberately aimed the gun at Akai Gurley, when, you know, I think we all realize that that's not what happened. And that's what got him convicted of manslaughter. Here again, there is a standard. The standard should be the crime and the punishment should be matched somewhat. And the sense of injustice is that this is way over the top.
For a cop, as good as I, a book of guy, drinking crooked eye, resist a pit and pie, you think I won't, but why wouldn't I? I'm a cop.
Here's a question that was front and center during the 2014 protests in Ferguson, Missouri. When someone is shot by a police officer, does the public have a right to know the officer's name? Reformers have been pushing for more transparency ever since. And as NPR's Martin Kossi reports, there's also been pushback from state lawmakers who say releasing names can endanger the police.
Legislators in Oregon generally take pride in their state's open records laws. But last week, they were in a hurry to carve out an exception.
Colleagues, this bill is deadly serious.
That's State Representative Jeff Barker. He said the head of the state police had come to him in a panic over the safety of one of his officers. It's the officer who shot an anti-government militant during the occupation of that wildlife refuge last month. The man who died has become a martyr for the anti-federal cause, and that's what worries Barker.
And there's people who want to know the officer's name because they're going to kill him if they can identify him. This isn't an idle threat or somebody saying, you know, off the pig or we're really angry. This is specific.
What Barker's proposing is actually pretty limited. Police can withhold an officer's name for 90 days if a judge agrees that there is a credible threat. But other states are considering broader shield laws. The Pennsylvania House has passed a bill that would prevent the release of any cop's name during a use of force investigation. It's a reaction against the Philadelphia Police Department's policy of releasing names 3 days after an incident, which is way too quick if you ask Joseph Regan of the Pennsylvania Fraternal Order of Police.
I think what most of the guys are worried about is their families. That's what they're worried about.
What's striking about the Pennsylvania legislation is that if no charges are filed against the officer, his name could remain a secret. And Regan says that's only fair.
What about when people make complaints against police officers and it's unfounded? Do we put that out all the time, too? Is that subject to right to know? The officer did nothing wrong. Why is the information being put out?
This view is contrary to what the reformers want. Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative was a member of the president's task force on 21st century policing.
I think that any effort to conceal the identity of someone in a moment of controversy undermines the ability to build trust.
Still, the reformers don't have specific rules in mind. There's no national standard for how and when an officer's name should be released. And that leaves the field open for state legislation such as the bill that just passed the Senate in Virginia. It lets departments keep all officers' names secret, not just those involved in shootings. Megan Ryan of the Virginia Coalition for Open Government says the bill is being justified in part by officer safety.
I can understand where that fear is coming from. I don't know that anyone has been able to trace any kinds of targeting against police officers to the fact that their name is public.
And the fact is, national statistics show there really has not been a meaningful increase in the number of attacks on police since Ferguson. Ryan says she gets it that many cops feel targeted, but she says that doesn't justify letting the police become an anonymous force. Martin Costi, NPR News.
The lineup, man, is a thing that I used to be in Peoria, Illinois. It's a small town, so I'd be in a lineup for entertainment on Saturday nights because there wasn't nothing to do. You know what I mean? Because ugly white women used to say they got raped by niggas.
Hey, a nigga raped me.
Yeah, and the guys be going, hey, you sure? Yeah, they go round up some niggas, you know, like, oh, you were down last week, you know what to do, don't you? Well, come on down again, will you? We got to have a lineup. You know, it was a lot of fun unless you got picked. That was your ass.
Story has come full circle of what did and did not happen inside Osborne Playground in Brownsville, Brooklyn. Early last month, five teenagers were accused, arrested, and criminally charged with raping an 18-year-old woman they found inside the playground. Fast forward to tonight, and Brooklyn District Attorney Kenneth Thompson announced those charges would be dropped because the story from the would-be victim, an 18-year-old woman, did not add up. Abdullah Green is the attorney for Ethan Phillips, one of the formerly accused.
When this news story first broke, it went nationwide. It sounded really horrendous.
So much has happened from the day the story first broke to its dismissal. First off, when the boys walked up on the young woman, she was actually in the playground engaged in a sex act with her own father. But she told police the boys tried to rape her, and she made no mention of having sex with her father. What helped save the boys? Cell phone video recorded by one of them that completely contradicted the young woman's story. In a written statement, D.A. Thompson writes in part, she also refuses to cooperate with any prosecution against her father, who was engaging in sexual conduct with her. It is my fervent hope that this young woman gets all the support that she needs going forward.
Well, I'm glad that the D.A. did an investigation and realized that this case had to be dropped. There was no criminal wrongdoing in this case whatsoever. I believe that this would not have happened if the truth had been told initially.
Community advocate Tony Herbert stands by his initial calls before the entire story came out to have the boys brought to justice.
The community wanted an answer. And I think, quite frankly, that because it had taken place and nobody really was notified that it had taken place, that the community was up in arms, you know, quite frankly, and yes, the pressure was on the police department, unfortunately, for them to do their job. And they did their job.
But defense attorney Kenneth Montgomery, who represents Denzel Murray, one of the other formerly accused teens, says a rush to judgment derailed the path to justice.
Politicians, police officers, everyone went in rush without actually investigating the case. Investigation is one of the most important parts of law enforcement, and that wasn't done, and it wasn't completed. Clearly, it wasn't completed.
Brooklyn District Attorney Ken Thompson ultimately concluded the sexual conduct of the father and the teenage boys, while consensual, was ultimately, quote, reprehensible, adding his office is currently working with the young woman to get her any help she may need. In Brooklyn, Jay Dow, Pix 11 News.
Let's talk about Hollywood and Hillary and racism, because as we all know, racism's epicenter is the Oscars and Hillary Clinton. Oh, wait, that's crazy. Wait a second.
Clearly.
Okay, but...
Well, they got part of it right. She is white.
Right. It is a little crazy that the protests I see have to do with the Oscars and with Hillary Clinton. A Black Lives Matter protester interrupted Hillary at a fundraiser and said, Hillary Clinton, can you apologize to black people for mass incarceration? You know, of the thousand things I could complain about with Hillary Clinton, being a racist really doesn't rise to the top of it. I mean, it's
And she's also used to getting the apologies.
It sure is fun being purer than everybody else.
Right.
But does this person realize that Donald Trump in South Carolina, 20% of the voters who voted for Donald Trump disagree with the Emancipation Proclamation?
Right.
And this is who you're going after? This is where we start the battle, you fucking idiots.
No, I don't agree with that.
I don't think,
I'll tell you why.
Bill, I don't think they were calling, let's be fair, just like when Kanye West said George Bush doesn't care about black people, he didn't call him a racist, although George Bush heard racist. They're not claiming as the Black Lives Matter that Hillary is a racist. What they're saying is that negative racial consequences flowed from mass incarceration. And by the way, when they accused her of talking about the super predator, which she did, let's note the fact she apologized. Bernie Sanders...
And it was taken out of context.
She was not saying
black people are predators.
No. She was saying super predators, the language that John DeLulio or somebody was using about black criminals during the second... But
yes,
here's my point. She at least apologized and acknowledged that was a problem. But I'm saying I think it's sexist for people to impute to Hillary Clinton what her husband did. Her husband was the president of the United States of America, not Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
Now, but I'm not mad at...
But one party does not even acknowledge that racism even exists. That's say it's an urban myth.
No. You're right. The Black Lives Matter implicitly are proving the humanity of the Democrats because at least they're humane enough to respond in kind to them. The Republicans don't give a flying damn about what's going on there, and therefore they prove their inhumanity. So in one sense, they're affirming it.
And George Bush is
the party that has spoken... The party that was supposed to be for black people has let them down continuously, and that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is going after the Democrats.
What?
Because they're the ones who are supposed to be on their
side. Exploiting them, taking them for granted. Taking them for granted. So look, as a person who believes that Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States of America, I'm telling you from a sympathetic position, there is no problem with Black Lives Matter challenging them because the Democrats have had a history, as Brother Ruffalo has said, of exploiting those black people. But at the end of the day, I think that Hillary Clinton is not only the smartest person, the most prepared person, but the person who has given the most credible empirical analysis of race in the last 20 years by a major American politician. I'll stand by it. Absolutely.
Right? People need to learn the difference between an imperfect friend and a deadly enemy.
No doubt.
You want to tear Hillary Clinton down? Great.
No.
Then enjoy President Trump.
Yes.
You only get two choices in America. Two choices.
But it's perfectly legitimate to keep Black Lives Matter at the front of what people are thinking about, right? Because if you're not there showing your issue, someone else is there instead.
Right.
And I think, you know, it was unfortunate the way she did it, but at least she'd been allowed into Hillary's thing. You can imagine that she would have been blocked from Trump's altogether.
When you turn around on the crowd, she's the only black person there.
This is a
$500 a plate fundraiser.
And we wouldn't be talking about this unless they
practice the politics. Why is that a problem? Do they have to be everywhere giving you money?
Who's they?
The black people? Really? I can't.
Yes, we should be everywhere. Yes, we should.
Man. No. Look, I can't use the term they.
That makes me
a racist.
Come on, Bill.
Yeah, I'm the problem, too.
You know I'm not.
No.
Not at all. But what I'm saying
is. You reacted when I said they.
No. I didn't react. That was not me, bro. That was him.
That was me.
That was him.
Kevin, I know I'm a light-skinned Negro, but I'm not a white guy, okay?
But they all look alike.
Bill, no. Actually, I'm sympathetic to you in terms of the argument about the efficacy of race. What you're arguing about, if I can dare to speak for you, is that let's be politic and strategic about getting even our friends who have made mistakes, who are imperfect, to do the things we want them to do. Let's not close them down so much, because if you keep practicing the politics of disruption to the degree that they don't get a chance to respond, then that's counterproductive. However, the reason we're talking about this today is because they have been effective in forcing a conversation that we'd rather avoid. But at the end of the day, I'm rolling with HRC to the end, because I think she gives a serious indication of what's happening in this country racially. So we can have Black Lives Matter articulating their concerns and Hillary Clinton responding to them better, by the way, than the occupant of the White House and others who claim to be the friends of African-American people as well.
Okay.
Damn you, Obama.
Here's what happened today. Melissa Harris-Perry walked off of MSNBC and said, they've been preempting me every weekend. I'm not going to do it anymore. So you just come out and say it if you're going to do it, right? Don't take me off the air implicitly, basically. And she has some pretty harsh language that had a racial component to it, like, hey, don't play, treat me like the person you trot out there and does a show. I don't want to misquote her. I don't have it in front of me, but it was strong. Okay, God bless her heart for that. And then also unrelated. Earlier in the day, Rick Tyler, the former communications director for Ted Cruz, was hired by MSNBC.
And why was he fired from Ted Cruz's campaign?
For being a notorious serial liar.
It was exceeding expectations.
Let's turn him into a journalist.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it is good training.
He's now the third most dishonest person that's corresponding for them.
Awful. Okay, so let's now, in the immortal words of Marco Rubio, let's dispel the notion that MSNBC is liberal, because they are not. Okay, to paraphrase Rubio.
He was just fired for being too dishonest to hang around with Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
It just happened. They didn't wait a month or 3 months. It was like 5 days ago. And they're like, yeah, bring him in every day. Every day.
Yeah.
He'll just give his opinion. He's an expert. He'll just give his opinion. No big deal.
And I want to give you guys context. So everybody who works at MSNBC can be used on any of the shows. So they're going to use Rick Tyler every day. If they want to, Melissa Harris-Perry, yes, has a weekend show, but they can use her on any show, right? She's under contract at MSNBC, but they weren't using her at all.
Yeah.
So, like, progressive voice. Okay. Oh, the guy who was too dishonest for Ted Cruz, too right wing. Yeah, come on board. So it's done. It's done. The MSNBC, if any of you thought it was still a progressive network, wakey, wakey, they're not doing that anymore. And by the way, let's also dispel the notion that they don't know what they're doing, because they do.
They do know what they're doing.
They do know what they're doing.
They know exactly what they're doing.
So it's not like the executives there were like, maybe we shouldn't have that progressive voice on anymore. But on the other hand, we could take a massive right winger and give him a nice contract.
Yeah.
That's not an accident. That's not like, oh, right. Oh, why didn't anybody tell us that he was an enormous Republican and she's an enormous progressive? Right.
No, Jake, they heard your criticism of Scarborough and Mika, and they were like, you know what? The dishonesty just got 10 feet higher.
To quote Trump.
No, that's the beauty of whenever Trump is on MSNBC. I really get a thrill watching their journalists speak small talk to power.
So I guess the new slogan for MSNBC is lean back.
Yeah.
Somebody getting some gin and juice. So anyway, that's that. There is no more progressive network on TV. Uh-uh. So I guess that leaves us, the Brady Bunch. That's what we look like right now. Anyway, so progressives, welcome. You've got a home here.
Yeah.
Okay. So if MSNBC doesn't want you, well, sad day for them, isn't it? Right? And those idiots couldn't get progressivism to work in the media. I'm sure that right now, and then earlier they had a conversation, liberals just aren't entertaining. I guess they just don't work on TV, right? I guess that's how it works. Yeah. I know. That's why all of Hollywood is liberal. But somehow liberals can't be entertaining. Or perhaps you schmucks couldn't figure it out. Maybe that's why the largest online news network, which is way more than three times your size online, okay, in your entire network, is a home for progressives. Oh, it turns out you can be entertaining and get all the progressives to watch you. You just didn't know how to do it. So don't blame liberals, because that's the next thing they're going to do. Oh, it's the liberals' fault. They don't know how to be funding. It's all Rush Limbaugh talking points, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we had to go to someone really entertaining like Ted Cruz's communications director.
Yeah. We can't be funny like Limbaugh and Mark Levin.
Hey, why are you sitting there about Mark Levin? Come on, Ted Cruz is the real conservative.
Okay, so maybe we should have like an Irish funeral for MSNBC. Like, get really drunk, have fun, you know, tip our 40s. It was nice knowing you, MSNBC. Yep. I was on there for a couple of minutes.
If Quinn Chapel is a Chicago institution, so too is Robert Henry Lawrence Jr. He served in the United States Air Force and became the first African-American astronaut. Unfortunately, he never made it into space. His wife, Barbara Kress Lawrence, recently shared his story with her sister, Lorna Kress Love, as part of the StoryCorps GRIO initiative. The project aims to capture the oral history of everyday African-Americans. She says Robert Lawrence faced many prejudices in his position. One incident she witnessed came with the initial reaction to his appointment and the local media's first phone calls.
And the person on the phone said, is this the Lawrence residence? And I said, yes, it is. And he said, there's a story in Chicago that Lawrence is a Negro, you know. And he said, is that true? And I said, well, the last time I checked, he was. You know? But it was just amazing that, people in the country would not have expected and could not believe that a Negro was going to be named as an astronaut.
So then what happened?
So Bob was flying as the instructor pilot to maintain his proficiency, which you had to fly at least 4 hours a month in a plane. And the afternoon of December the 8th, 1967, there was an accident. And because the plane came down tail first, Bob's seat, I guess the charge didn't fully explode so that he hit the ground and his chest was crushed. There were hundreds of condolences from citizens all across the country, but there were also several responses from other citizens. One in particular said that they were glad that nigger was killed. And that's the America that we lived in then and in many aspects still do. Now, the Air Force has wings that they give for various accomplishments in terms of length of time or flights. The Air Force has a set of wings that are called astronaut wings, and those wings are for people who have gone 50 miles in the atmosphere. When the situation came up about Bob not being on the memorial wall, they said that he was not an astronaut. Well, he was killed in an accident that was simulating what became space technology. And he was in a space program because it was the Manned Orbiting Laboratory, which was the Air Force's space program. And there were a lot of very awful things said about why he didn't deserve to be on the wall. And finally, we had to go to my congressman at the time, Bobby Rush, who had to write to the president, and we wrote to the man who was at that time the president of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who it turned out was a student at Bradley when Bob was the student commander of the Air Force Wing. Finally, after all of that, they decided and voted unanimously, although they had voted basically unanimously several times not to put him on the wall, to put him on the wall. And they did it in December the 8th, 1997, which was 30 years after he had been killed. There's a school in Chicago that was renamed for him as the Major Robert H. Lawrence School for Mathematics and Science. And Ohio State University has done a lecture hall, and Bradley University has an annual lectures series that they started in the name and of Robert H. Lawrence. So several institutions that he had been involved with, and I think especially the school, which was renamed because it was hoped that young children, especially young African-American children, because it is an African-American community, would think that, okay, here's a person who went to school in Chicago, went to grammar school and high schools in Chicago, and worked hard and accomplished these goals, and so that they could see that if you work hard and you have a dream, that you can do this too.
Chicago resident Barbara Cress Lawrence talking with her sister, Lorna Cress Love. They spoke about Barbara's husband, Robert Henry Lawrence Jr., the first African-American astronaut. She shared this story as part of the StoryCorps Oral History Initiative, and for more information, you can visit our website at chicagopublicradio.org.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 27th, 2016, so I have been told. Again, we will do a quick recognition. Barbara Cress Lawrence, the sister of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and Lorna Cress Love. She passed away last weekend. Dr. Welsing had been talking about some of Barbara Cress Lawrence, some of her health difficulties back in December. And then Lorna Cress Love also, when she was on our broadcast earlier this month, also addressed some of those same health concerns and hoping that, you know, things were going to be okay. But she did transition last weekend. Again, just taking a moment to recognize the loss. Very tough year for the Cress family. Moment of silence and recognition. Context of white supremacy. White team, tacky as usual. Even in death. Compensatory call-in. If folks would like to participate, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We are fundraising for 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. When you hit the blog, you will see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks to all the folks who have invested 7 years. We have been rolling. I hope the program has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also share the program. Post it on your blog. If you have a website or what have you, real estate online, share the content. You can tweet the program right now, put it on Facebook, wherever else you're on social media to let other victims of racism know about the cows, what racism is, how it works. Before we hit the phone lines, there are many things that I could say about some of the clips we heard, some of the clips that we did not hear. The only thing that I will say, Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing, I would have probably, or I would have tried to squeeze it in if I could have found time. Dr. Welsing, she addressed Melissa Harris-Perry before on this program. As I posted on Facebook, someone I know often says Melissa Harris-Perry is not the most powerful person on the Melissa Harris-Perry show, and that should be kept in mind at all times. But Dr. Welsing, she just pointed out, you know, little things. I can't even say little things, important things, like Nerdland, because I even saw that in the letter that Ms. Harris-Perry wrote explaining her situation, where it still had that tag in it, Nerdland, and Dr. Welsing said she felt that that was code. She said, number one, you don't see that when Brian Williams, known liar, when he comes out, or other prominent white journalists, when they come out to talk about serious issues and the news and what have you, they don't have those type of hashtags, something like that, Nerdland, and that sort of thing. They just come out, say what they're going to say, and that's that. She felt like it was almost a coded way of white people saying Niggerland. We just got, you know, this is for dark people to go over here and, you know, clown around and do whatever they're going to do. That was the way she interpreted it. She also thought it was significant that on the MHP broadcast, they would highlight Melissa. If you look at other content on MSNBC, she would pick out, like, Rachel Maddow's show. It would be Maddow. The last name would be highlighted, not the first name, which fits a long-running pattern of racism and disrespect of the names of black people. I also think it's important, Reverend Al Sharpton, his program on MSNBC, it used to be on every weekday. Now it only is on the weekends. Joy Ann Reid, she used to have a program on MSNBC. She's a black female that was on during the weekday. They canceled her show as well. Seems like removing of dark faces from MSNBC. I could be in error. We will go ahead and get to the phone lines. If you could watch the background noise, that would be grand, help preserve the quality of the program. If you could also watch the length of how long you speak, if you could kind of keep it to 5 minutes, that would be great. That way we can make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to share at least once. If you could, you know, give your commentary, share one time, and then allow everybody else to speak, and then we have time left if you have additional comments, questions, all that. We can make time for that as well. But if you could kind of hold it to 5 minutes, that would be great. I'll try and keep an eye on the time myself. No metaphors. Again, I do that for a reason. If folks don't understand, I would be happy to explain, but just briefly, it's been my experience that frequently people compare things that are not related at all, that frequently the metaphors are confusing, that often even the metaphors have an appeal to emotion as opposed to logic, where it will get you excited by the things that are being compared as opposed to just logically processing what is being said to see if it makes sense. Even it's been my experience that sometimes the metaphors that are used are just another way to name call non-white people. I've seen where that happens pretty consistently as well. And just, you know, really, if we want to be very clear about it, I think all of us, Gus T. Renegade, name at the top of the list, we should be able to express ourselves, our views on racism, counter-racism, clearly, explicitly, without having to employ a large number of analogies and metaphors and what have you. You should just be able to make it plain, make it explicit, so that there's no confusion about what's being said. I consistently see a lot of metaphors used when people discuss racism, white supremacy, and it frequently does not help. It frequently produces a lot of confusion and a lack of clarity. So for the compensatory call-in, no metaphors, please. Thank you. With that, we will get to the phone line. The top portion of the people who dialed in, your lines are open. I will just kind of stagger it and go down to kind of prevent some of the background noise, but I'll be moving to folks as they called in. So the first, like, five people that dialed in with a hand up, your line is should be open, and I'll be getting to the other folks directly.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Thomas Smith in New York. Just had some observations I wanted to make. First, rest in peace to Dr. Logan's sister. Sounds like her sister and her other sister, you know, she was a great woman, lived a great life, has a million stories, very clear about the system. I'm agree with Dr. Welsing, one of the observations I made, and, hopefully everyone could bear with it. But, I've been watching the coverage of the elections, and you played some clips about them. And barring an unforeseen event, it looks pretty clear that Trump's going to be the nominee for the Republicans in a huge landslide. I think as early as next week, they'll be wrapping up most of the South. I don't see him being competitive, anyone being competitive with him in the South. I remember when we were reading the Ben Tillman book, and I said, he sounds a lot like Tillman, And, I pretty much, see him in a general election winning the states of Florida and Ohio, the two that Democrats usually need to win. So I think that, Dr. Welsing was right. She hit it right on the head. Just based on that way it looks. The observations I made about it is the way I see it being marketed to us. On one issue, Trump is like a superhero. A superhero to some, a supervillain to others.
Lots of metaphors, lots of metaphors.
I got you. Let me put it in perspective, though, Gus. Until I went to work one day, I was working with Latinos, and it was around the time he made the war comment, and this was around the time that El Chapo also broke out of prison, and they were like, he's gonna get Trump. I mean, it was almost like, giving you that appeal, with him and his lavish 74-story, building, with the gold Trump sign in front. Sort of like a Bruce Wayne or Tony Stark's, just looking at it from that perspective. I wasn't trying to make a metaphor. Also not trying to make a metaphor, but if you look at who invented Trump, in my opinion, white people use black people's culture that we're able to scrounge up under the system to promote their system worldwide. And to sell products and goods, but most importantly, to sell and promote their ideas. And today, that culture is hip-hop that they use. It's the largest export that America has, other than white supremacy. For the last 20 to 25 years, his name has been mentioned in almost 60-something hip-hop songs. His name has become synonymous with the metaphor of being like a rich guy. I'm Trump, I'm the Trump tight, or, I'm the black Trump. And, a lot of this is something that, we created, if you look at it, marketing him worldwide, giving him that exposure that he probably wouldn't have got worldwide anyway, way before he was saying, "I'm fired, you're fired" on television. I saw a town hall meeting that appeared to be on rape. And I also said that no crime closely resembles racism like the crime of rape, because it's a crime of power. It affects the victim mentally and physically at the same time. Changes the way you relate to the world. It's a scar that stays with you, just like racism is. And, I watched this news program about rape, and I really wasn't paying attention to it. But as they started to get more into this role playing, how these people go on campus and they role play with the students and teach them, concepts and things, they're telling the men that, their aggressive actions, are something that they don't realize they're doing, like they're ignorant to being raped. Raping a woman. And I'm like, that caught my attention, because all the talking points they're using in this little clip is the same ones that the white privileged people use when they're trying to discuss racism. And I was like, man, this is crazy. This is like a probably what Tim Wiseman do when they go on campus, kind of coaching them, how to do it. one of the clips, you played one about the college. What, you know, I remember there was these two brothers. They played basketball. They were called the O'Bannon brothers. I think they played at UCLA. They both made the NBA. And they sued EA Sports, the video game maker, for the rights because they used their images in these college basketball games. And they're like, you know, here we are, two dudes with ball heads, and yeah, this is clearly us, even though they're just supposed to use the number of the athlete. It was like, you know, they sued and they won. And right after that, they were kicked out the league. And it's always a penalty because, like the guy said, the college sports have become a minor league for the professional sports. And I was watching a 30-30, and like that's what he says, these are usually about race, and this one was too. And it was the destruction of the Big East Conference. And that clip also reminded me of that, you know, how it was destroyed by big money deals, in particular the football deals. And I have a newfound respect after watching that for Patrick Ewing, for black self-respect.
We will leave. That's,
I'll go. I'll stop. Thank you.
We'll hopefully we'll make time so you can get the rest of your comments in as well. Other folks, did you all have comments? If we haven't heard from you, do you have comments you wanted to share?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you if you could speak up.
Oh, okay. Hi. Good evening, everyone. I wanted to send out my thoughts and prayers to the couple that was shot up by the police in Inglewood, California, I think about 4 days ago. Apparently, they were either asleep or unconscious in their car, and the police, for whatever reason, just shot and killed both of them. I think the woman's name was Keisha, her first name. I don't remember the man's first name. It begins with an M, like Mary. But anyway, if anyone hadn't heard of that, I just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention. And my condolences go out to their children. Both of them had 7 children altogether. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, everyone. My condolences to the family of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I was listening to the reports on Mr. Trump. It's still, in my mind, kind of early in the process, but I have no other thoughts but to agree with Dr. Welsing that Mr. Trump will be the next president of the United States. I can't see where that would not happen, although I don't know that much about it in order to make a pick or thought from some sort of experience. Also, in my opinion, with that type of situation is it doesn't appear to me that that position is as important as a lot of people say it is, as far as the maintenance of the system of racism and white supremacy. Because, you know, logic, agreeing with Mr. Fuller, that there's only one government, and that's the government of racism and white supremacy. There's no such thing, actually, as United States government. That's only a concept. As far as from a commercial standpoint, he certainly presents an image that I'm used to seeing out of the white people that I've been around on that job for 27 and a half years. And although I've retired from it, and I'm talking about white male as well as white females. Although I retired from it, I still see examples of that outside of working for the fire department, and that, you know, he's likable to a whole lot of white people that otherwise would not say or act openly the way he does, but he kind of like is their hero in so to speak. So I wouldn't be surprised if it happens. It wouldn't end the system of racist white supremacy, and he definitely couldn't do it worse as far as dismantling it. So from that standpoint, I think it's very possible. I noticed during the different reports, you had a lot on the people activity of entertainment and directly sports. The path through what is called athletic scholarships is a very, very tricky, very confusing path, let alone talking about getting through 4 to 5 years through college in that type of under that type of culture. And me being a high school coach, this is the last thing I'll be saying, that what I see is that there are very few people who are dealing direct with our young black males who have went through the path through its fullest, meaning going in as a scholarship athlete, applying themselves work-wise, athletically and academically, finishing with a college degree and in turn learning something. For the most part, you have different aspects of those former athletes who for some reason didn't finish from college, you know, that sort of thing. But yet at the same time, there's a whole lot of hype about playing professional sports, which is very unrealistic. And the young person doesn't realize it until they get to the point to where they no longer are at that university anymore, and the NFL and the NBA are slamming the door right in their faces. And in turn, in a lot of cases, what takes place is whatever that person was doing before they signed that athletic scholarship, they have to go back to that type of lifestyle or the start to start their lives from a standpoint of being able to take care of themselves. And so it's very tragic in that aspect. But a lot of work needs to be done, you know, along those terms. I heard the last week sometimes where someone said that there's a lot of racism involved in sports. They are exactly right. There is. Well, then again, you know, racism is everywhere. But anyway, that's just my report for this week. Ironically, I'm up in Orlando, Florida right now at a football coaches convention. I'm in my room by myself right now listening to the cows. So thank you. And the next person can go on.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Me as well, myself as well, I want to show my respects for Dr. Wilson's family right now. And I just wanted to add that about the UAlbany incident, that surveillance footage. It seems like they only released a certain time period of the footage, because I guess there were, I think, 12 angles, and the majority of the angles you can't really see, or for that matter, hear what's going on during the incident. And it seemed like the timing of it starts at 1:05 a.m., but I think on the police report somebody put up on Twitter, it said they boarded the bus at 12:52, so that's like, what, another, what, 10 minutes that they don't even have footage for. So that was very interesting when I think that was the defense attorney for one of the girls, the victims. Well, I'm still calling the victims. Said, you know, hey, the police department didn't even release everything. You know, what's going on here? And he said, this is unfortunate, you know, and I agree with him. So I think that was very, I was very suspicious from the beginning, and this is just doing nothing but further confirming it. Was that the attorney for one of the girls, Gus? Or?
Yes. In the clip that I played, it was one of the, I guess, yeah, it would be a defense attorney.
Yeah, because I'm like, man, that's that connection once again. And just to bring out the names of the three girls, like, hey, you know, this girl is 20 and this one is 20. And this is her first and last name. But the interviewing other witnesses, and blurring out their identities. And if I could add one last thing, I seen a, because I think something was on the audio clips about Canada. I seen there was this program on YouTube about racism in Canada, and that reminded me of that because they were blurring out the identity when they, because they like to do these shows about these experiments where they'll send in a white person to go to the store and non-white, you know, and as usual, the white person will get exceptionally well treatment, and the non-white person is followed and mistreated. So they will always blank out the perpetrator. And from what I'm seeing is I see like pale skin. So, and they was interviewing one guy saying, hey, you know, I believe in stereotypes and I just got to do what I have to do. But I'm suspecting this was a white person, and the white guy hosting the show saying, so you just discriminate against, you know, black people and things like that. Said, hey, you know, I have to do my job. And, but see, you cannot see him. You just see nothing but like a silhouette, you know, hiding that identity. But this is supposed to be a show talking about being against it, against racism. So this sounds like more confusion to me. And that's pretty much all I had.
Yeah. With that Albany situation, it reminded me, it was one of our listeners. She had a situation where she was assaulted at a gas station by a white man who actually poured gasoline on her and struck her. And I was discussing the incident and kind of asked Mr. Fuller for some of his thoughts. And he even reminded me of the program that we did with the black female where they were out. It was her and a group of non-white people. They were out at an establishment where they served alcohol, and these race soldiers were sitting around them. This incident was instigated by a white woman, and they ended up assaulting some of the non-white people that were present. Anytime where you're out in public and white people are saying anything to you, calling you names, where it's looking like this could head towards a confrontation, I would look to get out of there like immediately. If you're on a bus, if you're out at a party, like, it is time to go. We have done whole programs. White people can ruin your life in 5 minutes. You want to escape because it can go bad in a variety of ways in the system of white supremacy. Because actually the same thing happened in the incident where we did the program. The white people assaulted a non-white male. The non-white male ended up being the one who got charged. I had to go to court and spend all this money, wow, thousands of dollars to, you know, get his name cleared and everything, and at risk of losing his job and jail time and all this other stuff. He was the only one. None of the white people got charged. I think they all left. They had it on video, too, and none of them got charged. Nothing. Only the non-white person got charged, I think, for some property damage or whatever else it was. But just in anything where it looks like that's where it could go, I would recommend, like, get away immediately. If you have to get off the bus and catch the next bus. Like I said, if you, you know, or you're at some sort of meeting or what have you, leave. That's the best thing that you can do under this system. If it, you know, unless you absolutely have to defend yourself, and I didn't see the whole video, I wasn't there, but I mean, woo, if it gets to the point where you have to put your hands on a white person, it could go bad in a variety of ways under the system of white supremacy. That's just how they have things structured, unfortunately. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had a hand up, have not spoken, line should be open if we haven't heard from you.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, this, greetings, everybody. This is Puff. Just been listening to the program. I just want to make a suggestion. As far as the white radio, like, I guarantee you, like, if you listen to WTN conservative radio on, that's in Nashville, Tennessee, the talk radio station, I mean, it's like, I mean, I learned so much because the reason I learned so much is because they take calls from actual people. Like, they talk for a little while, and then they take the calls from actual people. And, man, the things I'd be hearing is like, man, it's like 90 seconds is worth 20 programs of the cows. It'd be that serious. It'd be, I mean, dead on point, you know, because they'd be discussing, like, things that happen locally and nationally and how they really feel about, you know, Mexican people and all this crap and non-white people and how they be seeing black women. And, you know, it's just to the point that you would learn a lot, put it like that. It wouldn't be a Welsing moment. It would be like Welsing hours at that point. And I also want to give my condolences to the Crest family. And to the people that got killed in Inglewood. I didn't know anything about that. He said that it happened 4 days ago. I just want to give my condolences out. And that's it.
That was post. Somebody put that on my Facebook page earlier this week. That was this past weekend, actually, Sunday. I'm not going to read the whole article, but it says a black couple in Inglewood, California was gunned down by police while sleeping. The incident occurred during the early morning hours of February 21st. Keisha Michael, 31, and Mark Quinton Sandlin, 32, were out on a date and were likely tired. After a night on the town, they decided to park their Chevy Malibu on the side of Manchester Road to get rest, according to NBC4. Someone called police because they thought the parked car was suspicious. When police arrived, they ordered Michael and Sandlin to exit the car, but the couple did not respond because they were unconscious. The officers apparently felt threatened by unconscious black people and decided to shoot inside the car. Michael and Sandlin were both killed. You can read the rest of it at Rolling Out. But, yeah, this happened about 6 days ago. Folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good Saturday evening to everybody. This is V from Western New York. I apologize for my tardiness. I'm writing right now, but I'm also kind of trying to get my mind around some of the news which I just heard, including the tragic deaths of that couple and the fact that they have 7 children who, you know, now have to go on without parents. As a person who lost his parents very young, I know that's not an easy circumstance. So, my condolence to them. My condolence to the Francis Press Wilson's family, and to just everybody. I just saw a post from somebody else that a guy was gunned down by police in, I think it's Montgomery, a couple of days ago, maybe a day ago or so. I'm losing track of all that information right now. But it has been an interesting week. As Thomas from New York said, I do expect Donald Trump by the end of this coming up week to be basically the GOP candidate for president. I was reading some articles on the poll numbers from Texas, from several of the other states that are getting ready to vote, and outside of Texas, and I think there was one other state where Trump is not leading, but both states have significant proportional delegates legislation, which says that if he receives X amount of votes, then he will receive delegates. Outside of those, Trump's leading comfortably. And he, I think, come Tuesday, will pretty much be the GOP nomination, or nominee, excuse me. And that in and of itself has really caused me to pause and think about the trajectory of this nation, of this country. I'm watching what's happening over in Europe and the, quote, the immigration crises, and some of the news coming out of there, some of the acts that are being committed, and how people are responding to even the potential of not black people, the majority of these people, just slightly tanned people coming into the into their countries, and how they're responding to that. I'm listening to white people around me talking about immigrants and immigration, and there's definitely something frightening in the air. So outside of that, I really don't have anything else. I do have something for workplace racism, which I hope to contribute in some time. Thank you very much.
Right on, right on. Other folks who have commentary that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Thomas in New York and all the other callers and the listeners as well. I came in kind of late. I was actually traveling while you were playing the clips. I'd gone to a it's an event they had it with my son at the Caribbean Cultural Center and Diaspora Institute, and it was a very interesting trip to and from, and the visit itself was incredible. But just to speak to the clips that I was able to hear, and just the discussion and some of the stuff I picked up on the Akai Gurley shooting, I thought about it, and I didn't know originally that the bullet that hit Mr. Gurley ricocheted off the wall. I thought it was a point-blank range shot just straight to the chest. So that kind of changed some of how I felt about it, even though I still think it was a race-based shooting, I guess for lack of a better way of explaining it. The only reason why I think so is because because they did state in the clip that the officer feared for his life, which is why the gun accidentally went off. I don't know how you accidentally press the trigger. It's either you press the trigger or you don't. But what really stood out to me was that they said he was fearful, and in his fear, he shot the gun. Well, my thing is, where did the fear come from? Racism, white supremacy instills fear of black people across the board. So I know if it's just basically impossible that if he bumped into a white male, he would have felt fearful enough to have his gun go off. It was because Mr. Gurley was black that he was fearful, and that caused him to shoot the weapon. So to me, this shooting is still an act of racism, white supremacy, in the fact that he, as a non-white male, was of course psychologically conditioned to be fearful of black males. Thus, the reason why he shot his weapon in the first place. I thought about the Melissa Harris Perry clip that you had your discussion on her and her mistreatment and the game they play with names, as far as them emphasizing her first name, which is of course a belittling thing to do in American culture, versus Rachel Maddow, who they do absolutely emphasize her last name in big block letters on every program. And it really made me think also of Peter Jennings. Peter Jennings was a renowned Canadian news reporter who ended up moving to the United States. And it wasn't until he died a number of years ago that I found out that he was actually a high school dropout. And a lot of his colleagues did not know that he was a high school dropout. But he's this renowned reporter, and Melissa Harris Perry is a, you know, a highly intelligent, educated young black female who's been perpetually abused on her own show, belittled and treated as a mammy. And then you have this white male who migrated from Canada with less than a high school education, and he's able to be lauded as one of the greatest reporters that have ever, you know, done reporting in the United States. So I just it made me think of that comparison. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was the five black males that were falsely arrested for the rape of that white female in New York. I was around a similar age of the Central Park Five when the Central Park Five happened. So there was a very powerful reminder of that situation and the fact that that could have been myself. If had I been out that night, I could have been one of those five people. And it made me think, she was being sexually terrorized by her father. And even though he was raping her, she was still willing to protect him as a white person and basically bury these young black males for something that they didn't do had they not had the camera footage to prove that it wasn't them that did anything. And the way that they're touting it in the news, they're saying that they're hoping she gets all the help she needs. She's a racist white supremacist who's literally protecting her father, who is an incestuous rapist. And again, the black people get discarded to the side. These young black males whose lives could have been absolutely ruined get stressed, who is being raped by her own father of all things. And this just goes to show the twisted psychopathology of racism, white supremacy, in the way that it conditions us to always put the needs of these white terrorists and these diabolical beings. And I mean, that's diabolical for you to be a rape victim from your own parent. And you even refuse to turn against your own parent to basically lie like white women have been doing for the last 500 years and basically ruin the lives of these five males. Another thing I wanted to speak to was, it was interesting. When I was traveling home from this event, there was a black sister at the end of the end of the escalator going to the train, and she had an extremely heavy bag. My son and I were at the other end of the escalator. There was a young black male next to this woman, and she's dragging this bag, trying her hardest to get down the stairs, and he's just watching her, and it's making everything, slowing the whole line. It's to my son, I said, like, black self-respect, like, why don't you just pick up the bag for this sister, help her down the stairs? But he's watching her struggle. And then, weirdly enough, there was another young black male right next to me who obviously was in earshot. I didn't say aloud because there were quite a few white people, so I didn't want them to pick up on it. But he was right next to my son, and he actually heard what I said. He said, man, you just spoke the truth. I said, it's just a shame. I said, we as black people, like, we're so disconnected. If she was white, she probably would have helped her with her bag. He's watching her, struggle, and he did absolutely nothing to help her. And my son agreed as well, but it was just interesting that this other young black male actually was in earshot. I just said, we as African people have a lot of work to do. And then he actually had a brief discussion with me about that. And, we moved on to the train. So that was an interesting incident. And it was weird because at this event tonight, I actually brought up Dr. Welsing because it was a panel discussion of Yoruba initiates. And they basically were discussing the history of the tradition in Brazil, Trinidad, Cuba, and the United States. And there were quite a few things that were incredible that were brought up in the discussion. But literally, and I said at one point, I said one of the guys in the crowd actually brought up Neely Fuller Jr. And I said, it's just so interesting that basically every problem and issue that everyone brought up in this panel discussion are all byproducts of the system of racism, white supremacy. And I said, well, we just lost the giant, Dr. Welsing. And she always talked about us as black people focusing on the root cause of the problem, not the symptoms. And in the panel discussion, everyone was addressing all of these symptoms and how they thought we could cure the symptoms. But they did bring up racism, white supremacy, but they didn't bring it up in a way in which it was completely understood that all of those problems were caused by racism, white supremacy. It was just something that I saw, and I alerted my son to that. I said, did you hear all of these things that were brought up? I said, these were all byproducts of the system. He said, yes. I said, that's what we need to focus on. And he understood what I was saying, and I spoke to a couple of people about it. The work to do as far as a people, not being driven away from the core issue, which is always white people, white racist man, racist woman, racist child, and the system of racism, white supremacy. Thank you for my call, and I'll mute my line.
For sure, for sure. Our female caller in the great Commonwealth state, did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I just wanted to comment on the a couple of the clips that you played. The clip about the rugby game if one needs to see an example of how white Voltron, then definitely that video is a clear example. I don't speak the language, so I am not sure what the song they were singing was saying. However, they didn't appear to be in any way threatening. And they were simply just singing on the field, and these white terrorists just all pour out, like, onto the field with a bloodlust. It was, I don't even know if shocking is the right word, but it definitely took me aback. And then the fact that the game continued an hour later also speaks to the complete disregard for non-white life and concern for their well-being. The clip about the renaming of, I guess, racist monuments in Quebec, I gathered. This shows the importance of not changing these monuments, because if, as the person who's being interviewed, Ms. Zellers, I think is her name, she said at the beginning that this is, that white supremacy is a permanent structure, and that these monuments, like changing the name, would somehow make the descendants of these victims feel better. And it just shows that if these name changes, they can only be used as a tool to further refine white supremacy and uphold that structure that she believes is permanent. And the idea that one can supposedly feel better about being subjected to the system, if you no longer have to see a rock called Nigger Rock, but rather it could be called something like Slave Rock, is absurd. And the idea that that even implies there's a difference between the two is crazy as well. The clip about the white woman who screamed rape, she completely altered these males' lives, and somehow that clip is, the way I heard it at least, disregards the fact that she altered those males' lives, and that somehow she's the sole victim in the situation and she needs to get support. Again, just another example of how white women are the most dangerous in this system. But that's it as far as my comments on the clip, and I would like to also extend my condolences to the family for their loss, as well as all the victims they've lost in the past. So that's it.
Just real quick on the New York situation, this false allegation of rape. The importance, monumental importance, of talking to your children about racism. It, at least from what I have seen in the reports, it seems if these young males, if one of them or whomever, if they had not had a cell phone to take video of this encounter, this could have went drastically different. Like, people were calling for the death penalty and standard things that they do to target black people. You know, they should be killed. Let's have a lynching right now. I mean, just even some of this would even be beyond racism. I mean, you just do not want to put yourself in difficult position, unnecessarily difficult positions. I think someone says pretty frequently that, you know, it would probably be a great idea to avoid intoxicated white people. And the reports that I saw, the dad, the raping, incestuous father, white father in this incident, he was so intoxicated that they couldn't even, you know, get a quality report of what happened when all of this went down. Just that is one off. Just the fact that they're white, that would be reason enough to, you know, let's get out of here like immediately. He's intoxicated. This is some sort of sexual thing and they're trying to involve us. Like, just the perversion abounds. But I mean, when you do not understand racism, white supremacy, it just, you are in such a vulnerable position. Like, their lives, I mean, they're already going to, as was stated, their lives, they're going to have to deal with this for the rest of their lives. And it's still seeming like white people are talking about them as though they are criminals and rapists, even though the charges have been dropped. They're still talking about this as the white female, the lying white female, that she is the victim in all of this. Talk to your children about racism. Just these type of situations are infinite in a system of racism, white supremacy. You really have to make quality decisions. Just keep saying it over and over again. Racists, they can totally ruin your life in about 5 minutes where you are like, what just happened? How did this happen? What is going on? I mean, it can happen quicker than you think. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
Can I speak?
Hello?
Female caller.
May I speak?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, hi, Gus. It's been a while since I called in. First, I want to say long live the spirit of Dr. Cress Welsling. When I heard of her death, I was very, very saddened, because it was on your show that I've never heard the woman before in my life, and I got to actually speak with her. So it was really sad, because I really wanted to actually meet her in person. But, of course, we have so many wonderful tapes that you did on her that always I can always get inspired and also learn. There were two things. I've been listening to you in podcasts, Gus, and I just want to say hello to the whole Cal listening audience. My name is Miss New Jersey. There was it was funny. I'm trying to piggyback on several calls with respect to racism. There was a clip you played where this woman, she was a white woman, and she was a I think she worked on a New York Stock Exchange now, but she was like trailer trash. And she had said that, you know, now that I'm not trailer trash anymore, I made it, that, you know, I don't have to look back on that life and be a part of those people. And I thought about what she said, because, see, you know, even though she was trailer trash, she's white. And she made it. I think she's working at the stock exchange, and she learned so many languages. She really just, like, revised herself or whatever. But, you know, with black people, it doesn't matter if we make it or not. We're still going to be black, and we can never say that, okay, I made it, and white people are going to look at us differently. You know, they're going to still look at us the same. Secondly, there was Frances Close Welding, and she made a quote about, you know, reparations. She said, instead of asking for reparations, we should look and seek to let America not apologize, but make sure that America knows that they are practicing racism against us, meaning that white supremacy is the root of what is causing mental illness, politically, socially, economically. Instead of really asking for reparations, we should look to seek that they should make this known and do something to improve it. And hopefully one day maybe we can, you know, everybody can expound upon that. So that's what that just kept rolling in my mind, because the organization I belong to is the People's Organization of Progress here in New Jersey. And we definitely, one of our demands, our core demands, when you get on our website, we do look for reparations, and we're still seeking reparations in terms of what our core demands are. So I just want to say, Gus, I love your program. I have another person who's tuning in, and I'm going to invite more and more people, you know, to listen to your program. You do such an excellent job. Your weekly wrap-up is just the best, and I just wish you all the best and continue with your work, sir.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. I think, M1, you were going to comment as well, sir.
Oh, yes. Hey, good evening. Last week, when we were doing the whole discussion on political correctness, I mentioned this rapper in California who was on trial for a murder, for singing about a murder that he didn't take part in. The rapper's name is Tiny Dude Duncan. I don't know if you, that is a fascinating case to look up if you ever want to, I mean, First Amendment, Bill of Practice, all of that. Say case of Tiny Dude Duncan. And the Peter, the conviction of Peter Yang, it's like how people are just so dismissive of a Thai girlie's life. Like, it was just an accident. You heard Mr. Liu talking about how, okay, you can get him for misconduct, get him for negligence, but you know, actually killing somebody, which is what Ms. Liang did. No, we can't. That should not be the case. And it was, of course, the reporter who, you know, corrected him on Mike Brown. It was like, you know, he just had to make sure that Mike Brown came at Darren Wilson. You know, just couldn't make Darren Wilson look like a bad guy for just shooting him in his car. No, Mike Brown just came at him. You know, the Bill Maher statement. Just more proof of his racism and how he'll talk, you know, he's one of those that likes to talk about, oh, you're Republican, you're racist. He'll constantly mention racism, but then when it's Hillary Clinton, it's like, if she's a racist, so what? That was the way he sounded. And being dismissive of the Oscars as a reflection of racism. I mean, the second biggest reason for the civil rights movement constantly say about him. And the report on police officers' identities being withheld because, you know, put their lives in danger. That's okay, fine. People had no problem publishing Joseph Walker's name the day after he was arrested. People have no problem publishing the names of Stafford and Greenhouse, Craig Taylor. I can go on and on. You know, I guess their names, I guess it's all right to publish their names. You know, that's all I have to say. Oh, the video I sent you, I don't know if you got it. Inspector Ray Soldier Harry Houck was on CNN, talked about Beyonce. Didn't talk about any of the cop killers. No. didn't talk about any of those cop killers that are the, any of those white cop killers that are the only ones killing cops this year. Because it's like, it's easier to talk about a black singer and her song than it is to talk about real white cop killers. And of course, another one was killed after that report. And again, no warrant cops, no Blue Lives Matter saying they're going to go to, they're going to go to Colorado to hold a rally to show support of law enforcement. That's all.
No surprises there. We have about 5 minutes left in the program. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm going to make it very brief. I just wanted to comment about Peter Liang. I think I'm getting his name wrong, or right? But I'm just curious. I keep seeing on the news that he's a rookie cop, and it seems like the whole argument is that, you know, hey, we understand that someone was killed, but, you know, hey, this happens. You know, I mean, that's kind of what it looks like to me. I mean, the argument is like, basically, white cops are getting off with this, so we should get off with it too. Because I guess my question is, how many, you know, for a rookie cop, how many black lives are you allowed to take before we prosecute you? Do we say, you know, each rookie cop gets 2 or 3 black lives that they can take without getting prosecuted, or 5 or 6? I'm not exactly sure, you know, but that's kind of what I'm getting from all the coverage about it. It's not even that, hey, you know, this guy was killed. Oh, this poor cop shot the guy. And nobody's mentioning about the fact that he's like, he was more concerned about his career than anything else. I don't know. I mean, obviously I wasn't there. I don't know exactly what happened, but the protest that I'm seeing doesn't seem to match up with what actually happened. I mean, at the end of the day, somebody died, and I think if it was anybody else, I know if I did that, I don't think that people would say, well, you know, it's the first person he killed. We should show some leniency. So that's the only comment I have with that, and I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm. I would be curious to see how all of this would be discussed if Peter Liang had shot an unarmed white male or white person, period, to see if it would be all of this. You know, this was a mistake, and, you know, he shouldn't be thrown in jail and fired and all. He's just a rookie cop, and, you know, this is just a total travesty of justice. I'd be very curious to see how all of this would be discussed if the victim had been white. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who had a hand up who has not shared? Grant, I assume we got everybody. I just wanted to comment really quick on the segment from Bill Maher. Like, wow, that was astounding on so many levels. Michael Eric Dyson was the one victim that participated in that conversation. All of the other folks that were there, I think they're all white. But that was Michael Eric Dyson who had the kind of concluding remark that he was riding with HRC Hillary Clinton to the end, and that she's done a better job. I think he said she's done like the best job of articulating racism over the last 20 years or so. And she's done even a better job than President Obama in addressing racism, white supremacy like that. I mean, that was one aspect that was profound. But Bill Maher, I've said this consistently, Bill Maher he's like right up there. Timothy Wise, Amy Goodman, super dangerous, extremely refined white supremacist, in my opinion, I suspect, because I think M1 pointed that out consistently. You hear, if you listen to his program, or if you watch it, where
The racists are the Republicans. The racists are the quote-unquote conservatives. Everybody else, all the other white people, are not racist. The white people that are voting for Bernie Sanders, the white people that are voting for Hillary Clinton is not a racist. Like, yeah, you might have a bunch of problems with her, but racist? In fact, he called the black people who were addressing, in my view, extremely legitimate, accurate concerns about Hillary Clinton and her record of racist conduct, in my view, saying that they were crazy. How, and I think he even used some profanities in there, like, how effing stupid are you to be going out and attacking her? She is your friend. She is with you, black people, and you're going to be talking about she is racist. How dare you? And I think they even inserted at one point that it was sexist to question her about things that Bill Clinton, when he was president, things that he did to hold her accountable for things that he did, policies and what have you, mass incarceration of black people during the 90s, that was sexist to somehow say that she is liable for things that he did while he was in the Oval Office. It was an amazing segment, even when it before Michael Eric Dyson got his concluding remarks. And he's a victim. I do think it is quite noteworthy that the last two programs that Bill Maher has done, they had non-white people, Killer Mike on the last one, vigorously supporting Bernie Sanders, and then they follow that up with Michael Eric Dyson vigorously supporting Hillary Clinton. Both of those individuals, I think, I suspect them of being white supremacists. I mean, whatever, if you're going to vote for them, fine, but I mean, at least these are racist suspects, and I'm going to vote for them because I think regardless of them being racist, they'll do whatever. But I thought it was amazing. He had the segment where he says, do they have to be here? And they were like, who is the they? Who are you talking about? And he says, black people. And it was the white guy sitting next to him that was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that you said that. Like, how would you? And he blamed Michael Eric Dyson. And I thought that is standard as well, where it will be another white person who makes an issue or points something out, but somehow it ends up going to the black person where they're held accountable, like, oh, my gosh, now you're attacking me as a racist. Like, it was a fascinating exchange. Like, it was about 5 minutes right towards the end of the program for folks, if you watch it or if you want to go back and watch the replay of it. Did anybody catch it, or any quick thoughts on that before we get to workplace racism?
Because the quick thought I have is, you know, I want to disagree with the other two callers, the firefighter, the retired firefighter, and their contention is that Trump is going to win, but my contention is that Hillary Clinton will win.
I'm just trying to hear about the last year. Hang on a second, because I'm not really interested in that. I just want to really chat on the clip specifically. That's great. You know, if you think Hillary Clinton's going to win, that's great. But did anybody have comments on that segment from Bill Maher specifically? If people don't have any comments on that specifically, then that's fine. We can transition to workplace racism.
Now, Gus, I absolutely do. I feel you with what you're saying. I checked out of Bill Maher a long time ago, but I've only been listening to him as you've been playing him. And particularly for that clip, it was very disheartening for me to hear Michael Eric Dyson in that position, knowing how strong of a critic he was, even of Bill Maher 10 years ago. And to see the amount of victimization, which has obviously pulled him and drawn him now into more of the mainstream eye, it's sad. It is really sad. But so, yeah, I definitely agree with you on it.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I agree with you on what you said about Bill Maher, and in particular when he went on his little rant about when Mark Ruffalo pointed out that the black female who asked her the question was the only black person there, and he goes into his rant on, do they have to get it was interesting how he jumps to assuming that it was Michael Eric Dyson who got tense or reacted to him saying they, when it was actually Mark Ruffalo, and it was really sly how when that was brought up, Bill Maher just shut up, and it leaves Michael Eric Dyson to be like, I know I'm a light-skinned Negro, but I'm not white. I agree. Bill Maher is very, very very, very, very still racist. Well, suspected racist.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, I think I agree with what everyone said. He's very skilled. And I think what Eric Dyson was doing was, you know, a few weeks ago, Gloria Steinem, racist and feminist, came out and made a statement about Hillary, saying that it's women who don't vote for her are, like, traitors. And Trump came out with a comment saying, hey, your husband was disgusting. Look at what he did in the White House. And he's already threatened, like, you know, Monica Lewinsky's not off topic, coming for this general election. I'm throwing everything at her. And I think that they're already trying to position how they're going to come with that, or that's feminist, that's, you know, sexist. So that's what I think he's trying to do. As for Bill Mayer, you know, he's a racist. We all know that.
Right on. Fascinating segment. I'm really glad. I watch every week just to study. I also pay attention to what they're talking to, but at least once a week, he will have at least one moment, sometimes multiple moments, where, in my view, the racism is explicit, it's clear, it's obvious. If you know what you're looking at, that was a great illustration, prime illustration. I'd say for anyone who's into counter-racist study, that is an outstanding five-minute clip to watch, just to see how it happens, because they just stick on that topic of racism for the full five, going right into the end. The crowd reactions, too, because, like, when he starts out by saying, you know, this is ridiculous to be attacking Hillary Clinton as a racist, and they're like, yeah, that's right, that's right. Like, man, white people are not ignorant about racism. Getting to workplace racism. If folks would like to participate, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. People actually emailed comments in pertaining to workplace racism. Just I'll get those really quick. And then other folks who are on the line, if you have commentary you would like to share. Number one person, they emailed the photograph and all of a white person, might be a so-called Jewish person, but they actually were asleep at work and not, like, nodded off for, you know, a couple seconds and then, oh, whoop, wait a minute, I nodded off, let me get back to work, get, you know, can't be wasting time on the job. This person actually had their feet up on the desk, head dropped, like, I mean, just in total snooze mode. And apparently it was not a problem. There was no reprimand. This person didn't get terminated on the spot. The person actually took a photograph of it. And he said, the listener said he showed this picture to another non-white male and stated that this white male could get promoted very fast due to the system of white terrorism. This is not white privilege. Absolutely, totally correct. The other person, I'll just read what they wrote. Yesterday, I was clocking out to go home when a white female coworker approached me and a few coworkers. She asked if we wanted to see a picture of a cake that she made in the shape of a penis. I already suspected what kind of cake it was. Sure enough, it was a large chocolate cake and testicles. She then pulled out a tin of mints and asked if we wanted some. The mints were white and tiny in the shape of a penis. I immediately thought of Dr. Welsing and the ISIS papers. We even had one more workplace racism person. I think it was Roz asked if they had observed white commuters, like, on the way home from work consuming alcohol, like, as they're leaving the job and, I guess, going wherever they're going. After work, we had a person write in who was on the subway, and they actually took photographs and said, yes, that they do observe this. They sent illustrations as well of the consumed alcoholic beverages. But, yes, that they have been seeing this, and they said that it's supposed to be against the regulations. You're not supposed to consume alcoholic beverages on the train. The conductors will come by and see these white people drinking their, you know, beers or whatever else they're drinking, and it becomes just a great little party scene. They will chat it up with them. Oh, how about the game? Blah, blah, blah. What are you going to do tonight? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, let me stamp your ticket. Boom, boom, boom. And no, you know, hey, you can't be consuming. You know, you got to get out of here. Let's call, you know, transit authority or somebody to get a citation or what. None of that. It's just all fun and cheer. And he said, as I said, he even emailed some photos
to support. But he did confirm what Ross talked about, I think it was last week. With that, workplace racism, if we had folks who had commentate. Okay. I will nab. There are a different set of people who dialed in, so I'm just going to check to see. The people that I'm just going to your line, caller in Michigan, caller at 6779. Let's see. People that called in that are newer callers, I'm just going to you all specifically at first to see if you all have commentary. Michigan caller 9315, did you all have commentary on workplace racism?
Happy Hurt?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I did have workplace racism commentary. Just wanted to give just a little more feedback to my experience with the law firm. I had made up in my mind that I was not going to go in on last Monday following the situation where I knew I was going to be fired. But it was interesting because Sunday night at I think it was 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, I got a phone call from one of the attorneys, one of the partners, to fire me. So he gave me a call, and he wanted to let me know that because the two non-white, non-black, they're classified as Chaldeans, those two associate attorneys had resigned, that he said, we're no longer going to need your services. So we have to do a lot of restructuring, and because they resigned, we're going to have to let you go. So, I got the call on Sunday evening that I was being let go, and just wanted to kind of follow up my my tragic situation at that law firm with the finale. So that is what has happened, and that's all I wanted to report.
Interesting. Seems you were processing things accurately with what you shared last week. Did what did you make of them connecting it to these non-white former employees at this company that I think you had shared last week that you felt that they too were being mistreated, also likely victims of racism, which led to them leaving, and that seemed to have caused some difficulties for the company, at least momentarily. What did you make of them connecting your termination to them leaving the organization?
I definitely think that it was a strong connection. I will admit that I definitely had conversations kind of pointing out the mistreatment and kind of, saying, wow, I mean, I know that my conversations, private conversations with them made them more aware of the mistreatment. They knew that they were experiencing, but they were just accepting it, and it kind of just became blatant. I noticed a change in their behavior and their attitude once, like after our conversations, and next thing you know, they resigned. So it was kind of abrupt. And they were, the white attorneys were used to the non-white, non-black attorneys, just going with the flow, just kind of, doing what they were told, giving no pushback. I remember when I was interviewed for the position, the white partner who interviewed me, she told me, you're going to have to meet with this one of our associates who you're going to be working for, which is the non-black, non-white associate, and he's really tough. He's really tough, so you're going to have to meet with him before we can make a decision. And so I interviewed with him, and I'm like, tough. I'm like, okay. I didn't get that when I met him. I'm like, no, he's just pretty thorough. But he wasn't tough. But I was just kind of like taken aback when she was saying how tough he was. And he really, in my opinion, wasn't. He was just thorough and his questioning. But all of a sudden, they gave them a lot of pushback, I noticed, after our conversations. And then they resigned. And then it was like, we're going to let you go. So I can see it's definitely in connection with just the relationship we had developed over the, little time that I was there. But I'm glad I'm no longer there, and I'm just taking good notes of of workplace racism. It is really horrific. So.
Absolutely. Just inserting, because I know this does come up a lot. Once again, if we have any black, what they call entrepreneurs, who quote unquote work for themselves, even though that is a mighty misnomer, because under the system of white supremacy, no non-white person works for themselves. Just because you have your own business does not mean that you are done with workplace racism. You will be in for a rude awakening because most of the businesses I've seen, if you do not have white employees or white patrons, you are directly, indirectly going to have to deal with white people to get a business license, perhaps a business loan. Depending on the type of business that you have, they have other licenses that you have to have, could be a liquor license or what have you. It does not by any stretch of the imagination mean that, oh, yeah, I don't have to deal with this anymore. That's just for you Negroes who are slaving for white people. That is not true. And I have seen that over and over and over. And if we have any black people who are what they call entrepreneurs, feel free to chime in. If I am in error, you can let me know. But this is when I have reached a firm conclusion. I have seen this up close. I know black, quote unquote, entrepreneurs, and they have had the same tales of woe of workplace racism. It's just going to take a different form. But at any rate, once again, we are back with, if folks have that directory or getting that list, if people want to work on ways that non-white people can work from home to try to minimize some of the direct contact that you have with racists on the job, that might be something that would be helpful, something that quite a few non-white people would appreciate, I'm sure.
I just wanted to say something really quick before you move on. I have been a quote-unquote entrepreneur for years prior to this incident, and you are correct. It's a fantasy, I guess, because when I was dealing with, just starting my own business, working for myself, I struggled thinking that I was going to do this without the aid of white people. I had to, when I really look at the type of work that I've done, I had to go to white people, to get, consistent, contracts. And I had to deal with them regardless. So it was just, I minimized contact, and that's the one thing that stuck out with me as an entrepreneur or quote unquote entrepreneur, and which is why I am still working on putting a list together of just things that you can do where you can just minimize the contact, because my experience from being in an environment where I'm going in the office every day around them for 8 hours a day versus working from home, even though I still have to deal with them, but it was just a minimized contact with white people and non-white people. It was a struggle financially, but peace of mind wise, it was better. But I kind of have to think about what I'm willing to give up, because I'm looking at it now, financially, it was better when I'm in that environment. But oh my goodness, it was mentally just nerve-wracking and painful. So it's kind of like, I don't know which situation is best or worse, because now that I'm back in a situation where I am not in that environment financially, I'm looking in a, I'm not doing as well. So, but minimizing contact with white people and non-white people, I would prefer. So just wanted to add that.
For sure. It is toxic. We've had people, there are studies, this is not Gus talking, they have done studies that show that it does have a detrimental impact on the health and well-being of black people, non-white people, particularly black people, just being in contact with white people. Like, they have studies that show that this is true. Not that, I needed that, but if you're interested in researching. Other folks have commentary they wanted to add or your own situations with workplace racism you would like to share. The caller at 9315, let's check, just trying to check people that dialed in more recently. 9315, did you have workplace racism you wanted to share?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. I have a, I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening for like 3 years. So I sell cars. And basically what happened, I just want to, I guess it's like a point to show how codified white people are and how they understand even when you're trying to be codified. So what happened was that I was working with like a young black kid, and I was gonna and I was basically closing the deal. So I showed him basically the numbers, like basically the sheet with the numbers on the for how much the cars are gonna be. So normally what you do, you get a commitment, and then like you go back to your manager and he'll tell you, oh, that's a deal, that's not a deal. So like I'm working with the guy, I'm trying to close him at what I think is a low payment. So I go to the manager and I'm like, okay, I got a commitment at 350. Then he says, 350 is not a deal. So I was like, I felt like 350 would be a deal on it. But the first thing I noticed when he gave me the first pencil, he gave me, like 420, and it didn't have the rebate. It didn't have like a rebate in it that he qualified for. So I point that out to him. He's like, oh, yeah, I happen to forget. Like, I clicked something wrong. And then, so he's like, yeah, like, we don't have a deal at 350. At 390, he said at 390 we have a, did he say three? He said, like, 390, like, 380 or something, and we have a deal. So I go out there. He gave me a pencil for 420. So I close the guy at 390. And then after he, like, after the deal was over or whatever, he was like, yeah, at 330 we had a deal. But, oh, but while I was, the thing was, while I was talking to him, he was like, I was like, yeah, I like this guy. Like, I want to get him a good deal. He was like, man, F this guy. Like, I know he's a young guy. He's cool. He's your people. Like, I know you want to give him a good deal. But he was like, he's not going to pay your bills. But basically, I want to point out how he saw that I was trying to help the kid out because he was black.
Wow. Excellent, excellent point, because they do that all the time where they have, I think, I don't remember which caller it was, but they were talking about the shows. I think the one in Canada where they'll do like, I guess it's reality TV. They'll send in like a white Confederate and a black Confederate to buy a car or something. And the white person always gets the better deal and better service. Like they do that all the time for cars where a white person will get a better price for a car. But I mean, that just that right there, even if you have a black person who is doing the selling, they still have to answer to white people that they can still come in and sabotage it to make sure that the black customer does not get a good deal. In my view, that seems like very, very, again, this doesn't sound like a white person who's ignorant about racism. Like, oh, no way. This, our little Negro here is not going to hook up this Negro employee with a good deal. We're not going to have that at all. Like, 390, let's bump that up a little bit. We don't want to get him, hook him up with any type of great deal purchasing our vehicle. We want to make sure we get as many of his coins as possible. And then after it's done, like, oh, yeah, we could have got it at 330. Oh, well, moving forward, like, they are not ignorant about racism at all. That is one of the greatest lies in the universe. Great illustration right there.
Also, I wanted to have something else real quick. This just happened today. That happened yesterday. This just happened today. Could I share it?
Yes, sir.
Okay, perfect. So, so I don't know if you guys know, but in Anaheim today, they had a KKK meeting, like a rally, and like three people got stabbed or something. I guess the KKK people got stabbed. And so one of this guy, we call him Alabama. He's a white dude, like a super redneck white dude, but he like listens to rap music and stuff. So. Like people at work think he's cool or something, but so he showed me this and I was like, oh man, that's funny. Like, cause the KKK guy got said, I was like, whatever. And then he was like, oh man. So people think the, KKK is just racist. He was like, oh, they're not racist. It's black people in the KKK. And I was like, oh, so, you are aware that when the KKK, was made, like, slavery was around. He was like, yeah, but he was like, the people just want to, basically he's like, yeah, they're the people who just want to make the South rise again. And I was like, okay. And then he said, so I said the slavery thing. And then he was like, well, some slaves got treated good. And he was like after they died, like the slaves would leave them, like stuff in the will or whatever, like the slave masters would leave them stuff in the will and what have you. And I was like, well, what about the other slaves? He was like, well, you know, like kind of like brushed it off. And then he said, so I was like, so what percentage of like slaves do you think were treated well? Like what percentage of slave masters do you think like treated them well? Was it like 10%? Was it 20%? Like what percentage was it? And then I was like, he was like, oh, I don't know. And then he was like, oh, I'm digging myself a hole. And then he walked away. And then after, so I'm, this is like 20 minutes later, I'm about to clock out. Then I clocked out. I walked outside and I walk him as I'm walking. As I see him, he was like, oh, yeah, 3%. And then he started laughing.
Wow. I said that at the beginning of the program, the tackiness has abounded, which is generally the case, but tacky, trashy, terroristic, as Mr. Fuller says all the time. That just that right there, and I mean, really, in my view, that's just total like trashing of our family. Like he's talking about our ancestors, and he's just, you know, making a mockery of this. 3%. Good day, Negro, as he, you know, goes off to end his day. I mean, that's what we have. And that's a great job. Stay in the question lane. Say that all the time. Ask questions as best you can, because I submit white people do this sort of thing. They're trying to get you upset. They're trying to get a response out of you to get you angry and just going around and arguing and what have you. If you say anything at all, try as best you can to just ask questions. If you do that, you can produce exactly what happened here, where the guy says, hey, I'm just going to wrap this conversation up. I'm not getting what I wanted. We're just going to conclude this and, you know, go about my business as a racist. That's excellent job, just to continue to just ask questions if you're going to say anything at all. And I would just a casual observation. I would even, maybe not in that situation, but I might ask a white person, like, because I hear that all the time, the kindly slave master, the well-treated slave. Do you think that some of the Jews in the Holocaust were treated well? You know, do you think they got hooked up with a great meal sometimes? Maybe they didn't have to go to the gas chamber. They got an extra pair of socks or what have you. How many of the Jews in the Holocaust do you think were well-treated? Because I never hear that some of the Jews were well-treated during that, or that you had good Nazis. I never, ever hear that. It's almost cliche that the first thing said is you did have some good slave masters. You did have some well-treated slaves. Other folks, did folks want to comment on this situation? Or?
Yes, actually, I did. I had a workplace racism incident as well, but I wanted to ask the female caller a question, and I wanted to comment towards the first incident that the brother brought up. The incident with basically trying to price gouge the black male that you were trying to assist, and big ups to you for black self-respect on that. I see that as a form of financial rape. Whenever you have a white person who does not know the financial situation of a black person, and in the vast majority of cases, we are trying to make ends meet and struggling and being underpaid and mistreated as it is, and they go to price gouge you in some way, it is a form of rape. We just aren't psychologically trained to see it that way simply because we're used to these things happening every day. But I just wanted to put that out there because it is a form of financial rape, just like the housing situation and all the other ways that they financially rape us. The question I have for the female caller was, originally, I was under the impression that they were going to let you go because if I remember correctly, you had stated that they tried to blame you for the work that the pregnant white female was not able to finish. And that was their original approach as far as the mistreatment that you were suffering. And it seems like they made a complete about face and went with what I would call the path of least legal resistance, which would be to state that these two non-white, non-black Chaldean females, their exit was the impetus for them letting you go. I wanted to ask, do you think that
because of the potential legal ramifications of the fact that they basically gave you the workload to dump on this female and directed you to basically mistreat her so that she would get terminated. Do you think that that's what they did as far as legally speaking, taking the path of least resistance by going that route and saying, because these two Chaldean females left, we no longer have any fear services? That was my question, and I have a workplace racism incident at some point. When I get the opportunity, I'll speak that. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
In response to the question, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because they didn't. I thought, I was actually surprised when I got the phone call. And when I was listening to him, the attorney that, you know, was calling, I'm waiting to see, like, what's the reason that I'm being let go. He specifically said it was because they have restructuring to do because the attorneys resigned. And, you know, because of this, you know, we're trying to figure things out. I'm going to have to let you go. Those were his words. And then he said, we're going to put it in writing. I never heard anything else about the, because prior to this, which was on, I think it was either the Tuesday or Wednesday, I was in the office with the female attorney who was dumping all, you know, like you said, you're right. She was telling me all the things that I didn't do, and it was my fault that the white female didn't do her responsibilities. And I pushed back and I said, well, I need to see exactly what I was supposed to, you know, follow up on the things that you're accusing me of. And she said, well, give me 24 hours. I'll have a list. But in the midst of this, this is when, you know, the attorneys resigned. I never heard back from her. She avoided me, that the rest of that week. I never heard from her. She never called me back in the office. She never gave me any follow-up. All I got was the phone call last Sunday telling me that I was being let go because of that. So I think that that was a way for them to cover themselves. He did say he's going to put this in writing. I have not received the letter in the mail yet. I haven't received anything. So they are attorneys. They are very slick and tricky with their use of language and words. So I'm sure they are trying to figure out a way to cover themselves. I had not been on that job for 90 days. It had been I started like December the 16th. I was not even, you know, 90 days. They had in their policy book, you have like 90 days probation. So I don't know. But it does seem like he was being very careful with what he was saying. And, you know, I should expect a letter in the mail, which I have not received yet. But, it was interesting that, they never followed back up with the so-called write-up that I was that she presented me with. I refused to sign, and it was convenient, of course, that the Chaldeans associate attorneys resigned, and they just, you know, used that as an excuse.
It sounds like that white female had her own psycho-terroristic agenda with you, and she might have jumped the gun, essentially, by going at you so hard. And maybe she basically doubled back and had a contact with the guy who ended up calling you. And he might have brought her to the realization that, no, we're going to take this a different route. She seems like she might have had a personal vendetta against you. Was she the female that you said was uncomfortable with the fact that you weren't as, quote, unquote, talkative on the job?
She was not, but she was the one when we had all went out to lunch. She insisted that I ride in the car with her, and it was two other black females that she had wrapped around her finger. She wanted to make sure I rode in the car with her to our lunch to this bar. And they made a joke like, oh, you know, Sherry has all the black girls with her. And I just was, you know, it was just weird because she wanted me to kind of, seemed like she was trying to recruit me on her little team, and it just didn't work. I was, you know, I just wasn't, you know, falling for her game. I gave her a lot of pushback, and you're correct. She did jump the gun with trying to write me up, and when she was not expecting the pushback that I gave her. I did notice when we were in our meeting, she was, I mean, just her facial expression, she was taken aback by me saying, nope, I want to see, you know, get what I needed in writing. I needed clear exactly why are you writing me up? What do you mean I'm responsible for this white female? Exactly what, you know, and so when I gave her all that pushback, she was really taken aback. She was stuttering. She didn't know what to say. And the white male that the attorney that called me, he was on vacation. Usually when she has meetings, he's sitting in the office with her as like the overseer. He'll sit there. He won't say anything. He's just like trying to intimidate people. So when she called me in the office, it was just, he wasn't there. He was on vacation. And I noticed that that was a big difference. She was definitely emotional and just, you know, just trying to be tough, I guess. But when he came back, I guess he fixed it.
That speaks volumes. The reason why I say that is because for him to have called you on his vacation means that she did something she was not supposed to do. It sounds like she might have been reprimanded, like, what do you think you're doing? And now I have to fix your screw-up. And she also seems like the type that was creating her little black plantation with her little niggas, and she was trying to add you to that, which is why they were saying, oh, Sherry has all the black people. Sherry has the plantation on lockdown, is what it seems like. And when she went as far as she did without conferring with the white clan, essentially they had to fix it by calling this man on his vacation to put out the potential fire, especially with the pushback you gave. She started to realize you think on your feet with mental dexterity and that she wasn't going to have just an easy go, whereas with the other two females, black females that you were describing, it seems like basically, like you said, she had them wrapped around her finger, and basically they were highly easily manipulated and a part of her little plantation she was creating.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it.
White people are something else.
Not They're ignorant dangerous. About racism. The person that dialed in, I have Roz's too. I'm just trying to make sure the people that haven't commented at all. The person that dialed in, 9607, did you have something related to workplace racism you were going to get in? Call
it. Hurt?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Good evening to Gus, Justice, the callers, and all the listeners. This is a workplace racism. This workplace racism is actually a workplace triumph. I know Gus talks about that sometimes. He'll mention it, and I just wanted to share this. I've written it down so I can get all my thoughts out correctly, so excuse me if it sounds kind of generic in any way. I'm saying this also to honor Dr. Frances Kreslowski and her passing. So I would like to report a workplace triumph. First, I'd like to say my respects to Dr. Frances Kreslowski. If it wasn't for her teachings, this triumph wouldn't have been possible. This is specifically due to the fact that on one of her visits, she spoke about black grocery store workers not being kind or courteous to other black people. And she would say, like, you know, just that they wouldn't be greeted or, you know, things like that, and that attitude should change. So I live in Southern California, and I work for one of the dominant grocery store chains out here. And for the last 6 months, I've been putting into motion her recommendation of greeting every single black person that I come into contact with. And it's not that I didn't ever greet black people before, but this time, like, I made sure to go extensively beyond a basic greeting, like, you know, just saying good morning or something. And I also do this in conjunction with limiting greetings to white people. An example, not putting the good on the morning, like I'll hear Gus say that sometimes after he's dismissing one of the guests off the show. He'll just say evening. And I'm not really like hoping them a nice day. I'll just say thank you, you know, for shopping here or whatever. But to all the black people, I'll extend my name. I'll extend help. I'll ask them to call on me if they need anything. And since I've taken this extremely like conscious, this conscious approach, I've exchanged phone numbers with two black males. I made relationships with several black females, and this is for, like, of all ages. I actually had a birthday recently, and a lady, this black lady, she actually said she'll come back and make me, she was buying some baking goods to make, like, mini cakes, and she said she was going to come back and make me a birthday cake. Now, there's two specific incidents that made me realize that I needed to take action and not just be a spectator, because Gus talked about that, and But there's an older black gentleman that comes in. He comes in the morning, and his attitude is like very, very discouraging, and it's like it's uncourteous. And even with that, like, we had an incident between us where he had came through my text stand, and he was just like real grumpy, like real angry. He was like mumbling under his breath, and he was directing it toward me. And so I had to realize what Gus says. He says it consistently, that whatever problems, whatever gripes, whatever frustrations we have, and this man had, it's directly or it's indirectly due to racism, white supremacy. And the other was this black female, and she came in. It was around the holidays, and she was looking for oven cleaner. So she walks up to me, and she's like, I need some oven cleaner, and it better not have any fumes. And it's like she just had this, like, real funky attitude. And so she was actually standing, like, not even a foot away from where the product was actually located, you know, and because I'm at work, you know, I just still have to be courteous. So I said, oh, man, it's right here, you know, and I gave it to her. And those two incidents, like, they kind of just stuck with me. Like, I think about them all the time. I even had a coworker, he was standing right next to me when the lady, like, had the attitude, asked me about the oven cleaner. So, you know, he's non-black but non-white, a Hispanic gentleman. And, you know, he was like, dang, what was all that about? And I was like, you know, I just have to kind of play it off, you know. But like I said, it's just like it's been on my mind, like, all this time, like, why they act like that. But I wish that I would have shared this with our grandsister, Dr. Francis Trethewelsing. But even with that, within that, the action that I decided to act on was her observation, and it was based off her logic, it was based off her experience. And as Gus, Dr. Francis Trethewelsing's sister, Lauren, Neely Fuller, and countless others that have said that action needs to be taken. We can't just sit on the bench. We can't just sit on a bunch of ideas. And a bit of advice that I want to give to everybody is, like, no matter how small you think, like, an act or an action of anti-racism is, and or black self-respect, I just encourage everybody to do it, because you don't know how the smallest act can have the biggest impact on somebody else. But like I was saying, like, just me acting on that, like, I make sure I go way beyond expectation to any black people. And then, you know, I just make sure I greet them. I make sure I talk to them. And if it wasn't for Dr. Francis Cross Welding, like, saying that, you know, and it resonated with me, because that's actually what I do. And, you know, the grocery store industry is very big. So I'm pretty sure there's other callers or somebody, you know, on the caller line that's really related or, you know, related to that occupation, you know. But it hit me directly, because I was like, man, you know, like, that is a big thing, because I see, you know, when black people come in, they just under stress, like, just the daily lives that we have, the things that we go through, we're just under all that, you know. And to come in and somebody's, like, smiling, and somebody's, you know, they're greeting you, and, you know, like, it just kind of lifts something off you, you know. And, I just, like I said, man, I just want to pay my respect to Dr. Francis Cross Welding and say that I applied that to her. You know, and I just want to leave you guys with, you know, don't help people. Don't help white people. Not even with the ketchup. You know, and reading and writing is more important than watching TV. And that's why I said in the beginning that I wrote this down, because I think it's important, too, you know, that Gus always says to, like, to make sure we can clearly articulate the things that we want to say. And I haven't shared on the call in a long time. And me writing it down, I keep a folder of everything, like the notes, you know. And I think I'll be able to look back, or I have a daughter, and, like, maybe one day when she's older, she'll be able to look back and read through these notes, you know. But Gus says when you write stuff down, it becomes more clear, because our minds don't work how we think they're going to work, you know. And for me to be able to refer back to what I shared on the cows, but these are also my experiences. But I did have a couple questions. I'm sorry if I'm taking too much time. But is it codified for me, is it codified behavior for me to, like, not overly greet white people? Like, so I try to do it in a way where, you know, I'm not disrespectful and I'm not uncourteous, but I just want to limit it, you know, and I just make sure, you know, like, there's no negative thing coming back to me, but I'm trying to focus my attention more on black people. And another situation that I'm having is, how do I talk to black people? Well, let me see. When I talk to black people, I feel like for a younger crowd, for younger black people, it's hard for me to talk to them, because if it's a female, I get the feeling like they feel like I'm trying to, like, get at them, like I'm trying to talk to them to get their number. But, like, I'm married, I got kids, man, like, it's not that. And I'm starting to think, like, I discussed it with my wife, and I'm like, why do I get that feeling, like a black female be like, don't talk to me, like, you know, I'm just like, man, I'm not trying to talk to you, I'm just trying to be courteous, I'm trying to be nice, you know, because I'm thinking, like, maybe nobody feels like that. And so when I discussed that with my wife, she said the same thing. She said, I can't even say hi to a black man because that makes me feel like he feels it's an invitation to be like, oh, so with you, you know, like, and it's just weird, like, especially at work. Like, if I talk to another younger black male, it's kind of like, oh, man, this dude's a square. Like, why is he talking to me like that? Or, you know, and I'm just like, man, like, I can't get over it. And I don't really know if it's a, I don't know if anybody can answer. Honestly, it's kind of not clear what I'm trying to express, but I don't know if anybody else feels like that, you know, like, or they have an answer why black people feel like that. Like, you know, like, you try to talk to a female, they think you're trying to get at them, and it's like, it's not even that. It's just like, man, we need to be courteous. And sometimes it's discouraging for me because when I run into those situations, I'm like, man, I'm not even going to say nothing to nobody because, you know, it's like they give me attitude, but then, you know, I think back, and I'm like, okay, this is bigger than me, you know, it's like I need to extend my courteousness, and I need to uplift black people, and this is me practicing black self-respect, you know. And I don't know if anybody has any answers or any, you know, anything like that or something that can help me, but I just, you know, it's hard for it to be, you know, for me to persist, like, when I feel like I'm getting negative feedback for something that I'm trying to do, you know, positive or whatever. But just to wrap it up, you know, I want to thank everybody, retired firefighter 909, Thomas Smith, Puff, the caller from Alabama, Joy Karma, Shanning, the caller that does the prayer sometime, all the callers from outside the states, like in different countries, Mr. Demery Ford, Lady, and every caller that shared in the workplace racism, because this is really a blessing, something that Gus has put together, because anything that anybody shares, I've taken a little bit of information, and there's a lot of us that don't call in, and like the caller, he said he's been listening for 3 years, and there's so many of us out there, you know, that I know this information is very, very valuable, and I just want to say thanks, Gus, for putting this, you know, this segment together, because it really is important. But thank you to all those callers for everything that you share, whether it's reading on the compensatory call, the book club, anything. And I just want to thank you guys for listening. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Appreciate that. I guess the two quick, because I did hear two questions. Dr. Kanban, I think he would give a rousing endorsement, KamalKanban.org, guest on the program repeatedly about, I've heard him say that exactly. I think he said it on the program. It might have been a private conversation, but I think he repeated it on the program too. But that, yeah, when you are on the job, speak to everybody. You speak to the white people, speak to non-white people. You're not trying to be aloof or ignore them or anything like that. But exactly what you said, I'm not trying to be overly friendly and hugging them and, you know, giving them the biggest smile that I can, just, you know, minimum what I need to do. Hi, Helen. Morning. Don't even say good morning, afternoon, evening, right? You know, keep it moving. Business questions, no problem. Let's do what we came here to do, that sort of thing. But I think the way that you articulated, just, I'm not going to go over the top, you know, to be a happy black person for you on the job. I'm just not going to do that. Going to make an effort to minimize that. And try, if I am going to go overboard with courteousness, it's going to be to other black people, even if it's not, you know, necessarily reciprocated or whatever the case. I'm going to try to exercise some black self-respect in the way that I have contact, communicate with other black people. I've heard Dr. Kanban, and I think even some of our listeners have said that they kind of have that same sort of code in place for the way that they function on the job and elsewhere. So, yeah, I think that's no problem there, at least in my view. The other one, in terms of how people respond to you, if it's black females think that you're trying to talk to them, or black males just like, why is this, you know, why is this guy talking to me at all? Like, get out of here type of a thing. And your wife saying that she has seen the same thing. I think it's just the anti-blackness, the toxicity of racism, white supremacy, I think is so high that I think black people are just not accustomed to other black people, really anybody, black people or white people, anybody coming to them for any sincere reason. Like, it's got to be, oh, if it's, you know, if I'm a black female, if it's a guy, then, you know, this is something sexual. He's trying to get my number for some sort of sexual hookup or, you know, something. You got some sort of con or scheme. Like, we just, I just think in this environment, we just are so accustomed to people not coming to us for anything constructive or even just nice. I'm not coming trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to do anything to you. I'm just acknowledging your presence as another black person and wishing. I mean, that is unheard, at least for me. I mean, if other people have that, that's great. I hope it continues. But that's not my experience. So I think a lot of us just have our guard up very, very high. We're very defensive. We're very suspicious that you're trying to do something, trying to beat me out of some money. You're trying to get my number. This is a sexual thing or whatever the case may be. I just, that's what the system of white supremacy produces with the way that black people are, I was going to say treated, but I think more, it would be more correct to say that's just, we are mistreated constantly by everybody. So I think that could be what you are experiencing. I'm even leery when black people, anybody comes up to talk to me, because that's just not my experience. People generally just do not come to talk to me about anything that is of constructive value. It is, you know, some nonsense, something that's non-constructive most of the time. Folks have, if anybody had a quick comment that they wanted to get, I guess you could be brief because I still wanted to make sure I got Roz, and I think we had one other person who had a workplace racism. Did anybody have any, want to respond to those two questions? And definitely would just make sure I get in my appreciation for exercising some black self-respect. I know Dr. Francis Cress Welsing would have a big smile with that, and someone making it their business to say, I'm going to go out and make sure that I do my best to do right by black people. That is outstanding. Folks have a quick response that they wanted to get into the what our caller just shared?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I do the same thing. I work in healthcare, and when I deal with black people who call in for assistance, I really go out of my way to help them. I speak to them in a very, very courteous manner. If they're going through some sort of healthcare issue, I give them a lot of positive encouragement. In some cases, I'll even, you know, take their name and pray for them, things like that. When I deal with white people, it's straightforward to the point, and basically, you're out of here. I'm courteous to white people on the job, but plutonically courteous. With black people, there's a marked difference in how I relate to them. And there's a lot of cleaning workers on the job where I work, and security guards. All of them are non-white. There's one black security guard, one Filipino and Latino security guard. And then there's a bunch of Caribbean Latino women who do a lot of the cleaning. And I go out of my way to be very courteous to them and very respectful. And I remember there was one day, there was an older Latino woman who I spoke to, and she just seemed shocked that I even acknowledged her presence, because she seems to be ignored quite a bit. For the second question, what was the second question again? It's slipping my mind because I had the answer right on the tip of my tongue.
Black people are leery. Black females think you're trying to get their number.
Yes. I make it a point to be very courteous to black people. As a matter of fact, one day I was going home on the train. I'm married as well. And I saw a crystal black woman standing there waiting for the train. And she was just absolutely beautiful. Her skin was like velvet. And I went out of my way. I went to her. I said, good afternoon. I said, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, you're very beautiful. Your skin is just beautiful. And I just said, you know, I just wanted to compliment you because I just thought that you were just a very attractive woman. I said, I'm a married man. It's not like I'm coming on to you, but I just wanted to pay you a compliment just on the fact that I just love your dark skin. I just think it's amazing. And she said, thank you. I could tell she was kind of taken aback by that. And I thought of Dr. Welsing. This is something I've done all my life, because I was pretty much raised to see other black people as brothers and sisters. So though I completely understand it, when I talk to my wife about Gus's stance on him being averted to anyone calling him brother, I completely understand it, and it makes logical sense. But when being that I'm a 70s child, and I was raised by parents who spent some time in the struggle and raised me around people like Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark, these are the kinds of things that are basically in my blood. So it's hard for me to step away from that. But when I go out of my way to be complimentary to black people, I have not received, at least in the New York area, a negative response to it. Usually they respond kind of in a shocked manner, like they're not expecting a black person to actually be respectful, courteous, or nice to them. I guess I don't know if it's where you are and the type of anti-blackness that's exhibited there, but I have not had that direct experience where someone's reacted that way. But again, I do hope that eventually the climate changes to the point where we become more accepting of black self-respect and that kind of of expression of our connection to one another as black people.
Retired firefighter, were you going to comment?
Yes, sir. I would like to say that I go out of my way, especially on when I go to the grocery store or jobs, other jobs that are where the people actually deserve more for their service, for the work they do, and they have to deal with the public, and go out of my way to speak to them. I make sure that I address that male as sir, the lady as ma'am, because they don't get it a lot. A lot of times people just kind of like ignore them, and a lot of times actually sometimes are disrespectful to them. And I have yet to remember a time where the response is constructive. It's always constructive. Also with the ladies, if the right situation is, and they have their hair in a natural style, I compliment them on it. And I may even go as far as some cases is to identify it as a sign of consciousness and strength on their part, on their behalf. And I don't do it if it's right next to a black female, another black lady that may have her hair perm, because I wouldn't want to make her feel bad of any type of way in that way. So, but normally if I'm fortunate to have seen in some cases, like when I've been to the bank where there's the whole row of black ladies have their hair in natural style. So, and I literally address all of them. As far as giving them compliments on their hairstyle and how they're wearing it, so that's basically what I have experienced as far as that concerned. Thank you.
For sure. Take one. If anybody else, take one more comment. If folks want to respond to that, and then we can get Ross's workplace racism that he wanted to share as well. Anybody else want to comment on those two questions?
Yes, I do. First thing I want to say is what the firefighter said. He said before on the show he always addressed the people as sir.
Your line is breaking up a little bit. Line is breaking up a little bit.
What the firefighter had just said, he has said before on the show how he always addressed black people as sir, ma'am, same way he would address white people. And I started doing the same thing after he said that the last time on the show. And, you know, you do get shocking results sometimes. I want to say that black women are the most disrespected women. The way that we do talk to them sometimes comes off very, very much like, you know, being nice. But, you know, we have other intentions and they're used to that. So you kind of have to expect them to somewhat be taken back. As for the other issue, you know, I find it's always good to be very courteous to your white coworkers, because that's when you get good information from them. When you stop by the desk, you know, they might be a little bit more forthcoming to talk to you. One of the first times I wrote Gus, I told him about a coworker who told me about her killing a black boy, you know, so... You know, just being nice, hey, Bob, how are you? You know, whatever their name is, you know. It's, you know, because my thing is I want to ask you questions, you know. So I'm going to be nice to you, you know, and I'm shoot you questions here and there. So I think the guys are definitely on a good path. I wouldn't go out of my way to treat black people differently, because white people do watch. And I'm with my mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to say thank you. Yeah, thank you for everybody for your suggestions too. Yeah, I'm gonna keep that in mind. I believe it's Roz. I like what you said. It sounded good, I guess, for me to, if I do compliment a black woman, or if I talk to them just to say hello, to articulate a little bit more to make sure I get across that, you know, I just want to make sure that you're having a good day here, and I'm just here to help you, you know, because I am at work. So yeah, I understand it. Thank you too. Yeah, I'm gonna. continue to greet white people, but just not overly. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you to everybody. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. I mean, this is serious, but right on. I did want to, I might have to confirm, but I think we did have another listener who styled in before where they were doing the same thing on the job in terms of being extra courteous to black people. And they still speak to white people and everything, but they're just not going to be, you know, extra courteous in the way that they deal with them. And illustration, if a black person sneezes, they'll be like, oh, bless you. And if a white person sneezes, they just don't say anything. And I think this person had said that the white people noticed that. Just, I think Thomas said that they are extremely observant, which I would surely highlight. That is absolutely true. It's been my experience. But I mean, if you just want to talk about the level of detail in terms of them noticing and making observations, I do think a listener told me that the white people did pick that out, that this person would say, bless you to the black employees, not to the white employees. And I do think that that was noticed. Roz, were you going to share your workplace experience?
Yes, I was just cracking up, but yes, what you just said had me splitting my side. Yes, my workplace racism incident was, I was helping a white lady on the job, and we were corresponding via email, and I had the initial contact with her on a Friday. I was supposed to be in contact with her that following Monday, but that Monday, I actually did not realize that I had a vacation date that was scheduled. So I went to my coworker, because normally if you have a ticket where you're following up with someone, basically I passed it off to him and asked him if he could follow up with her on my behalf. And I explained to him the situation, and there was some follow through that he was going to complete for me and then correspond with the female. So he took the ticket, everything was good. And this was January the 18th. And I think around that time, or just sometime in January anyway, just recently, this same woman creates a brand new email correspondence. And in the email, she speaks about the fact that she was initially in contact with me earlier in January, and that she never heard back from me was how the comment was phrased. And in a form of which I guess she was agitated and like I didn't reach out to her or have any correspondence. Now, mind you, when I went to the original ticket, instead of her responding where she actually had correspondence, and the history in that ticket was, my coworker who took the ticket over had about 5 different contacts with her. As the situation was resolved, essentially she ended up having a bill she had to pay for, and she didn't get the response that she wanted, which was that the bill was going to be taken care of. Based on the codes that were submitted by the provider, she basically ended up having to make a payment, and she wasn't happy about it, and there was nothing she could do about it. So instead of her basically taking that information, because my coworker explicitly told her on 3 occasions what the situation was, she basically created this ticket as if I never responded to her. So what I did was I responded to her original ticket, and I said, well, there's at least 7 different correspondences you had with my coworker, because I was absent the following day, that following Monday that I was supposed to be in touch with you. And I said, throughout that correspondence, he explained to you that the claim was submitted for investigation, and because of those codes, you have to make these payments, and there's really nothing else that we can do to basically satisfy in a way of the company paying this particular bill. And then I attached the original ticket with the correspondence that she had with him to the second correspondence, where she basically lied. And it just goes to show that white people are just the most calculating, with forethought, genetically negative beings ever, because it just the fact that you would create a brand new correspondence and then refer to me by name, because we deal with each other with the members on a first name basis, as far as just us not giving our full details to the member, but just our first name. And she refers to me as if I'm irresponsible. And there's a complete history there where it shows that I basically passed this ticket on to someone else. The information that he needed was there. He did the proper follow through, and he ended up closing that particular ticket. And she didn't get the response she wanted. So because of that, she's going to blame me and then basically try to throw me under the bus.
And I was just, it didn't work out in any negative way towards me because of the fact that I have a black female supervisor. She doesn't take things like that in that way in which she's basically, they look at the members understanding that some of these members do really, really underhanded things at times when they don't get what they want. So it didn't even turn into anything, but it was just the fact that she attempted to go there. And I've experienced similar things with white people before, but this is the first time I've had that happen with a member on this particular job. And that was the situation. And again, it just speaks to keeping records and keeping correspondence and keeping notes, because you never know when you'll have correspondence with a white person and they're going to do something terroristic and basically outright lie, like the white woman with those poor five black males who almost lost everything to try and destroy your life. Thank you for listening to my workplace racism.
For sure. Glad that it worked out. Seemed like it worked out well for you. Right on. And I think that might have been the first time that we get positive commentary about a non-white supervisor on the program. That is outstanding. Yeah, that documentation, we say that all the time. You do not want to rely on your memory. That's something that sounds like that is a plus to have the documentation there so that this is not a I said, he said, she said. Let's just look at the ticket. Let's just look at the paperwork, and that's that. This is what happened. This is what I did. We told her about this. Everything was done the correct way according to policy and procedure. It's lined out. Excellent to have documentation. And yet again, we talk about white women. Frequently, I've said, particularly in the workplace, I think that they are especially dangerous. But just on the whole, with regard to racism, white supremacy, white women and their deception, and a lot of times it can be very vindictive. If, you know, I heard this correctly, where she didn't get what she wanted, and, you know, it's like, I'm going to go and blame it on Roz. It's his fault. He didn't do things correctly. Really have to be mindful about them in all situations, but I say especially on the job, very important to be mindful of what they're doing. With that, we did extra. That's why I said the compensatory call-in will be restructured. I'm just trying to figure out how that's going to go. If workplace racism, I think, could maybe sit on its own as a separate program, I think we'd have more time to. Yes, sir.
Can I make one quick comment on one of the workplace racism calls? Please?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that case where the guy was a used car salesman,
mm-hmm.
I think that was such a great case of workplace racism because we don't usually get the back ends of things, you know, and it just that's how the system plays out. You know, we don't get the loan. We don't get the job. We don't get the apartment. And just to hear how it plays out in the background, you know, man, 390, you know, but it could have did it for 330, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was just such a great case of not just workplace racism, but just the system of racism, white supremacy, all in general, how that played out.
For sure. And again, white people are not ignorant. I mean, that's why I laugh when I hear that. It's no way that you could be ignorant about racism and do something like that. And I think the caller said that he made it clear. I know this is your homie. This is your black guy. And you're trying to, you know, hook him up. But we're not going to do that. And then once it's been signed at 390, oh, yeah, we could have probably done that at 330. But it's been signed now. Oh, well, not ignorant about racism. It's deliberate. Deliberate all day, every day, all areas of people activity. We should be here on Monday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. This, I think we played it, the clip a couple weeks back on Virginia Christian, black female. She was sentenced to the death penalty in Virginia, early 1900s. She killed her white female employer, where she had been falsely accused of stealing a skirt. And physically assaulted by this white woman. She ended up defending herself and killing this white woman, and they sentenced her to the death penalty. It's a white person who wrote this book, but it's fiction. I generally don't read fiction, but it's not like anybody has written a nonfiction account, at least I haven't seen it, of what happened with Virginia Christian. And I was born in Virginia. I graduated from UVA. I did not hear about this case while I was in school. I don't remember people talking about this. This is not exactly ancient history, but he did write a fictional account that is based on what actually happened in this case and some of the factual details. He should be here Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I know we have Virginia listeners. You should definitely tune in. I am a big advocate. One of the ways you can learn about racism, just
state history, what has happened in the area in which we live. That is a great way that you could teach your children about racism, white supremacy, because there'll be places where you can just go down the road and see things and learn about what has happened. So looking forward to that this coming Monday. And just I always appreciate examples when people say that black people are lames and chumps and cowards and we haven't fought back. That is so not true. There are so many black people past. Right now, I mean, you don't even have to go all the way back to the Haitian Revolution or Nat Turner or Denmark Vesey or anything that happened on the continent. You don't have to even go that far back. You can pull things to just from the last 10 years of black people using counterviolence to try to deal with racism, white supremacy. That's just one that really agitates me highly because it is so false and is so just discourteous and disparaging of black people, our family, people who have done exactly that and displayed maximum courage. And going up against an awesome force, racist man, racist woman, racist child. But looking forward to that this coming Monday, 8 p.m. If there are any, I guess I'm talking to black females specifically, if there are any black females, kind of short notice because I was indecisive, but the next book that we're going to do, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, her book, she's a black journalist, black mental health. She is a suicide victim, but she wrote a lot about racism, white supremacy. She had a lot of her essays published in the Washington Post. I had a black female who was willing to read this book, but she is doing the narration for Medical Apartheid, which is a gargantuan book, and I just don't have the I just don't think it's correct to ask her to do all this reading, so I'm trying to see if any other black females would be willing to read the book. I guess it's short notice, like you would have to either already have the book or be able to get the book in relatively short order to be able to do the first set of narration for this coming Friday. If any folks are interested, have the free time to be able to do so, that would be great. It would be nice to have a black female reading a book that was authored by a black female, but if not, I can read it. We have had that before where it was mismatched. We had a it was a white male author, but it was a white female who did the audiobook narration for the book, so we have had it before. But if there are any black females who would be interested in reading her book and able to get the book and do the narration by Friday, let me know. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. I do have this book. Unfortunately, I do not have an e version. I could share it a lot easier that way, but I have a hard copy of this book. So if that is workable, let me know. Looking either way, that'll be the next book. So if folks want to prepare, if you want to get a copy of the book, I don't know if this book will be as easy to find at the local library or not, because it's an older book. It's 20-year anniversary. It was published in 1986, but that is the next book. Looking forward. Outstanding. Leonida McLean, she's the one who wrote the article when Harold Washington was elected first black mayor in Chicago in the 1980s. She wrote the article how Chicago taught her to hate whites. Just incredibly powerful essay. I read a portion of it when Pam was with us at the end of last year. That essay, amongst many others, it's a fantastic read, and black mental health at the center. So looking forward to starting that this coming Friday. If you have questions, gripes, complaints, suggestions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, and we'll be back in 48 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, all areas of people, activity, and every single time we are in contact with another black person. Again, as much strength, energy, healing as possible can be sent to the Crest family. Has just been a devastating year for them. Our thoughts and prayers are with them, all black people, but thinking of the Crest family in particular. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.